AI in New York, 99.5 FM.
The Midnight Ravers, where every show is a special.
You are tuned to WBAI.
I want my freedom.
New York. 99.5 FM.
You gotta get me my freedom!
Streaming on www.wbai.org. Freedom of Speech Radio.
Welcome to Bob Fass's Radio Unnamable, a stake in the ground of alternative radio for more than 50 years. WBAI continues with a reading of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. It's a continuous reading of the novel, a WBAI reading from 1970 preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives. We're broadcasting the reading each Thursday into Friday evening at midnight, so please be sure to tune in, and if you miss any part of it, you can check for it on our website, WBAI.org. The edition we're using is the Signet Classic Edition, translated by Ann Donegan. We now bring you part 13 of our three-hour reading of Tolstoy's classic novel, War and Peace. As Napoleon's army draws closer and closer to Moscow, women are evacuating. There are posters throughout the city to boost morale. And Pierre decides, after he hears about the Battle of Shevardino Redoubt, to join the army. He ponders why one would sacrifice everything. Our first reader is WBAI's host of What's the Frequency, Kenneth.
This is Paul Fisher, and I'll be reading from Book 3, Part 2.
Chapter... And due to technical reasons, we're going to have to restart this on a different device, because the device that's playing has vanished, meaning I can't do anything about the overnight. So I guess I'm stuck here till 3 o'clock, so I can continue with my work. And now on with the show.
When Borodino fought, there was not the least sense in it for either the Russians or the French. Its immediate result for the Russians was...
All right, that didn't work either, because I can't turn off the one that's disappeared. All right, we got to switch to the other computer and screw everything up for the rest of the evening. Please, stand by. You're tuned to, of course, the home of faulty computers, WBAI New York. Oh, my goodness gracious, snakes alive. Well, why don't you enjoy this while I look for the program on this machine?
Greetings, this is Dr. James McIntosh, host of Mindfield, which comes to you every Wednesday at 2 p.m. on WBAI 99.5 FM. Together with my co-host, nurse family therapist, Richardina Theodore, we delve into the explosive issues in mental health. Our mission is to help you know yourself, release your anxieties and your depression, and free your mind. Only on WBAI, the voice of the voiceless, can we voiceless ones be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
Hey, remember me?
Yeah, you do that announcement.
Yeah, right, yeah. It's the station identification. I need to do it again.
Well, hold on. How about I do it?
Okay. Yeah.
So it's you turned to...
Tuned to.
Yeah, you tuned
to radio
to
station.
Radio station WB... What is it?
AI. WBAI.
Oh,
you
yeah.
tuned to WBAI New York.
Listener Spangled.
Sponsored. Sponsored.
Listener
Sponsored.
Non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York.
Streaming at
WBAI.org. Huh?
Good. Really? Well.
Will you get back in there?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks.
That's right. WBAI currently running 5-6 minutes behind schedule, which will no doubt keep up for the rest of the night. Unless I can reboot the other computer and switch it over. We're jumping ahead. Jumping ahead to wherever we left off on the other computer.
A very definite.
Maron.
Gare decides after he hears about the Battle of Shevardino Redoubt to join the army. He ponders why one would sacrifice everything. Our first reader is WBAI's host of What's the Frequency, Kenneth.
This is Paul Fisher, and I'll be reading from Book 3, Part 2, Chapters 19 and 20, pages 906 to 915. The Battle of the Shevardino Redoubt was fought on the 24th. On the 25th, not a shot was fired by either side, and on the 26th, the Battle of Borodino took place. How and with what object were the battles of Shevardino and Borodino given and accepted? Why was the Battle of Borodino fought? There was not the least sense in it for either the Russians or the French. Its immediate result for the Russians was, and was bound to be, that we were brought nearer to the destruction of Moscow, which we feared more than anything in the world, and for the French, that they were brought nearer to the destruction of their whole army, which they feared more than anything in the world. The result then must have been quite obvious, and yet Napoleon offered and Kutuzov accepted this battle. If the commanders had been guided by reasonable considerations, it would seem that it must have been clear to Napoleon that by advancing 2,000 versts and giving battle with the probability of losing a quarter of his army, he was heading for certain destruction. And it must have been equally clear to Kutuzov that by accepting battle and risking the loss of a quarter of his army, he would certainly lose Moscow. For Kutuzov, this was mathematically clear as it is that I have one man less in a game of checkers and go on making even exchanges, I am bound to lose, and therefore I should not make the exchanges. When my opponent has 16 men and I have 14, I am only 1/8 weaker than he. But when I have exchanged 13 more men, he will be 3 times as strong as I. Up to the Battle of Borodino, the relation of our forces to the French was approximately as 5-6, but after the battle as 1-2. That is to say, before the battle, 100,000 to 120,000, and after the battle, 50,000 to 100,000. Yet the shrewd and experienced Kutuzov accepted battle, while Napoleon, who was called a military genius, gave battle, losing a quarter of his army and still further extending his line. If we are told that he expected the occupation of Moscow to end the campaign, we may say that there is much evidence to the contrary. Napoleon's historians themselves tell us that the Smolensk, or from Smolensk onward, he wished to stop, knew the danger of his extended position, and knew that the occupation of Moscow would not be the end of the campaign, for he had seen at Smolensk the condition in which Russian towns were left to him, and he had received not a single reply to his repeated declarations of a wish to negotiate. In giving and accepting battle at Borodino, Kutuzov and Napoleon acted irrationally, and contrary to their intentions. But later, to fit the accomplished facts, historians adduced cunningly devised proofs of the foresight and genius of the commanders, who of all the involuntary instruments of world events are the most slavish and unwitting. The ancients have left us examples of epic poems in which the heroes provide the entire interest of the story, and we are still unable to accustom ourselves to the fact that for our epoch, history of that sort is meaningless. As to the other question, how the Battle of Borodino and the preceding Battle of Shevardino came to be fought, there also exists a very definite, well-known, but absolutely false account, All the historians describe the affair in the following way. The Russian army, they say, in its retreat from Smolensk, sought the most favorable position for a general engagement and found such a position at Borodino. The Russians, they say, fortified this position in advance on the left of the road from Moscow to Smolensk, and almost at right angles to it from Borodino to Utitsa, at the very place where the battle was fought. In front of this position, they say, a fortified outpost was set up on the Shevardino Redoubt for the observation of the enemy's movements. On the 24th, we are told, Napoleon attacked this advanced post and took it. On the 26th, he attacked the whole Russian army, which had taken up a position on the field of Borodino. So the historians say, and it is all quite incorrect, as anyone who cares to go into the matter can easily see. The Russians did not seek out the best position. On the contrary, during their retreat, they had passed many positions superior to Borodino. They did not halt at any one of these positions because Kutuzov did not wish to occupy a position that was not of his own choosing, because the popular demand for a battle had not yet expressed itself strongly enough, because Miloradovich had not yet arrived with the militia, and for countless other reasons. The fact remains that positions at Borodino, where the battle was fought, far from being strong, was no more a position than any other spot in the Russian Empire that one might happen to choose by sticking a pin into the map at random. Not only did the Russians not fortify the position on the field of Borodino to the left of and at right angles to the main road, that is, the side on which the battle was fought, but until the 25th of August, 1812, they had not even thought of the possibility of a battle taking place there. This is shown first by the fact that before the 25th there were no fortifications there, and that those begun on the 25th and 26th were not completed, and secondly by the position of the Shevardino Redoubt. Situated as it was in front of the position where battle was accepted, the redoubt made no sense whatsoever. Why was this redoubt more strongly fortified than any other point, and why were all efforts exhausted and 6,000 men sacrificed to defend it till late at night on the 24th? A Cossack patrol would have sufficed for observation of the enemy. And as a third proof that the position on which the battle was fought had not been foreseen, and that the Shevardino Redoubt was not an advance post of that position, we have the fact that up to the 25th, Barclay de Tolly and Bagration were convinced that the Shevardino Redoubt was the left flank of the position, and that Kutuzov himself, in his report written in hot haste after the battle, speaks of the Shevardino Redoubt as the left flank of the position. It was only much later, when reports on the battle were written at leisure, that the inaccurate and singular statement was fabricated, probably to justify the mistakes of the commander-in-chief, who had to be represented as infallible, that the Shevardino Redoubt was an advanced post, when in reality it was simply a fortified point on the left flank, and that the Battle of Borodino was fought by us on an entrenched position previously selected, whereas it was fought at an absolutely unforeseen and almost unfortified place. The affair, evidently, came about in the following way. A position was selected along the river Kolokob, which intersects the highway not at a right angle but at an acute angle, so that the left flank was at Shevardino, the right flank near the village of Novo, and the center at Borodino at the confluence of the rivers Koloka and Voina. To anyone who looks at the field of Borodino without thinking of how the battle was actually fought, this position, protected by the river Koloka, presents itself as an obvious choice for an army whose object was to check the advance of an enemy marching along the Smolensk road to Moscow. Napoleon, riding to Valjevo on the 24th, did not see, as the history books say he did, the position of the Russians from Utitsa to Borodino. He could not have seen this position because it did not exist, nor did he see an advance post of the Russian army. It was only when in pursuit of the Russian rear guard that he came upon the left flank of the Russian position at the Shevardino Redoubt, and, to the surprise of the Russians, moved his army across the Koloka. And the Russians, not having time to begin a general engagement, withdrew their left wing from the position they had intended to occupy, and took up a position which had not been foreseen and was not fortified. By crossing to the other side of the Koloka, to the left of the highway, Napoleon shifted the whole forthcoming battle from right to left, looking from the Russian side, and transferred it to the plain lying between Utitsa, Semyonovsk, and Borodino, a plain no more advantageous in position than any other plain in Russia, and on this field the entire battle of the 26th of August took place. The following map is a rough outline of the plan of the supposed battle, and of the battle that actually took place. Had Napoleon not ridden out on the evening of the 24th to the Kolokhov, and had he not then ordered an immediate attack on the redoubt, but begun the attack the next morning, no one would have doubted that the Shevardino Redoubt was the left flank of our position, and the battle would have been fought where we expected it. In that case, we should have probably have defended the Shevardino Redoubt still more tenaciously. We should have attacked Napoleon in the center or on the right, and the general engagement would have taken place on the 25th on the position we had foreseen and fortified. But as the attack on our left flank took place in the evening after the retreat of our rear guard, that is, immediately following the action at Gwidneva, and as the Russian commanders could not or would not begin a general engagement then on the evening of the 24th, the first and most important action of the Battle of Borodino was already lost on the 24th, and obviously led to the loss of the one fought on the 26th. After the loss of the Shevardino Redoubt, we found ourselves on the morning of the 25th without a position for our left flank, and were forced to turn back this left wing and hastily entrench it where it chanced to be. But not only was the Russian army on the 26th of August defended by weak, unfinished earthworks, but the disadvantage of that position was increased by the fact that the Russian commanders, not having fully realized what had happened, the loss of our position on the left flank and the shifting of the whole field of the forthcoming battle from right to left, maintained their extended position from the village of Novo to Otitsa, and consequently had to shift their forces from right to left during the battle. As a result, throughout the entire engagement, the Russians had to face the whole French army, directed against our left wing, with but half as many men. Poniatowski's action against Utitsa and Uvarov's on the right flank against the French were separate from the main course of the battle. Thus, the Battle of Borodino did not take place at all as the historians, trying to conceal the mistakes of the commanders, even at the cost of diminishing the glory due to the Russian people and the army, have described it. The Battle of Borodino was not fought on a selected and fortified position with forces only slightly weaker on the Russian side, but as a result of the loss of the Shevardino Redoubt, the Russians accepted battle on an open and almost unfortified site with forces half the number of the French. That is to say, under conditions in which it was not only unthinkable to fight for 10 hours and arrive at an indecisive result, but unthinkable even for 3 hours to keep an army from total destruction and rout. On the morning of the 25th, Pierre was leaving Mozhaisk, at the declivity of a huge, steep hill down which a winding road led out of the town past the cathedral on the right, where a service was being held and the bells were ringing. Pierre got out of his carriage and proceeded on foot. Behind him, and preceded by its singers, a cavalry regiment was descending the hill. A train of carts carrying men who had been wounded in the previous day's engagement was coming up the hill toward him. The peasant drivers, shouting and lashing their horses, kept crossing from one side of the road to the other. The carts, in which 3 or 4 wounded soldiers were lying or sitting, jolted over the stones that had been thrown onto the steep incline to give it the semblance of a road. The wounded men, bandaged in rags, with pale faces, compressed lips, and knitted brows, gripped the sides of the carts as they were jolted and jostled against one another. Almost all of them stared with frank, childlike curiosity at Pierre's white hat and green swallow-tailed coat. Pierre's coachman shouted angrily at the convoy to keep to one side of the road. The cavalry regiment, coming down the hill with its singers, overtook Pierre's carriage and blocked the road. Pierre found himself pressed against the side of the road that had not been cut out of the hill and was forced to stop. The sun did not penetrate into the hollow of the road, and it was cold and damp there. But overhead was the bright August sunshine, and the bells chimed merrily. One cart, with its load of wounded, stopped by the side of the road close to Pierre. The driver, in his bast shoes, ran breathlessly to the back of his cart and placed a stone under one of those wheels, which were without tires, and set about adjusting the breeching on his little horse. One of the wounded, an old soldier with his arm in a sling, who was following the cart on foot, caught hold of it with his sound hand and turned to look at Pierre. "Well, fellow countrymen, will they set us down here or take us on to Moscow?" he asked. Pierre was so lost in thought that he did not hear the question. He was looking now at the cavalry regiment that was marching towards the convoy of wounded on the road, now at the cart by which he was standing, in which 2 wounded men were sitting and 1 was lying, and it seemed to him that there in them lay the solution to the questions that engrossed him. One of the pair sitting in the cart appeared to have been wounded in the cheek. His whole head was wrapped in rags, and 1 cheek was swollen to the size of a baby's head. His nose and mouth were drawn to one side. This soldier was looking at the cathedral and crossing himself. Another, a young boy, a fair-haired recruit, as white as though there was no blood in his thin face, gazed at Pierre with a fixed, good-natured smile. The third lay prone so that his face was not visible. The cavalry singers were now abreast of the cart. Ah, with head all mazed, living in a foreign land, they sang the military dance tune. As if in response, but with a different sort of gaiety, the metallic notes of the bells reverberated from the heights above, and the hot rays of the sun bathed the top of the opposite slope with yet another sort of cheer. But under the hillside, where Pierre stood by the cart with the wounded soldiers and the panting little nag, it was damp, dark, and dismal. The soldier with the swollen cheek looked angrily at the cavalry singers. "Ah, the fops," he muttered disparagingly. "It's not only soldiers I've seen today, but peasants, too." "Peasants, even they have to go," said the soldier behind the cart, addressing Pierre with a melancholy smile. "They're not so particular nowadays. They mean to throw the whole nation against them. In a word, it's Moscow. They want to make an end of it." In spite of the incoherence of the soldier's remarks, Pierre understood what he wanted to say and nodded his head in agreement. The road was clear again, and Pierre walked down the hill and got into his carriage. As he drove on, he kept looking to either side of the road for someone he knew, but he saw only unfamiliar faces of military men belonging to various branches of the service, all of whom stared with astonishment at his white hat and green swallow-tailed coat. After driving four versts, he at last met an acquaintance and greeted him with joy. This was a doctor, one of the heads of the Army Medical Service. He was driving toward Pierre in a covered gig with a young doctor sitting beside him, and on recognizing Pierre, he told the Cossack on the driver's seat to pull up. "Count, Your Excellency, how do you come to be here?" asked the doctor. "Oh, I wanted to have a look. Yes, yes, it will be something to see." Pierre got out and talked to the doctor, explaining his intention of taking part in the battle. The doctor advised Bezhukov to apply directly to Kutuzov. "Why should you be off God knows where in some obscure place during the battle?" he said, exchanging glances with his young companion. "In any case, His Serene Highness knows you and will be glad to receive you. That's what you should do, my friend." The doctor seemed tired and in a hurry. "So you think, but one more thing I wanted to ask you. Where exactly is our position?" said Pierre. "Our position?" repeated the doctor. "Well, that's not in my line. Drive through Tatironovo. There's a lot of digging going on there. Go up on the knoll. From there you'll be able to see," said the doctor. "One can see from there? If you would..." But the doctor interrupted him and moved toward his gig. "I'd be glad to show you the way, so help me God, I'm up to here." The doctor pointed to his throat. "I'm racing to the corps commander. You see how matters stand." "You know, Count, there'll be a battle tomorrow. Out of an army of 100,000, we must expect at least 20,000 wounded, and we have in stretchers, cots, attendants, or doctors for 6,000. We have 10,000 carts, to be sure, but we need other things. We must do what we can." Pierre was struck by the strange thought that of the thousands of men, alive and well, young and old, who had stared with amused surprise at his hat, perhaps the very men he had noticed, 20,000 were inescapably doomed to die or be wounded. "They may die tomorrow. How can they think of anything but death?" And suddenly, by some mysterious association of ideas, the descent from the Mojave's keel, the carts with the wounded, the slanting rays of the sun, the pealing bells and singing cavalrymen, vividly recurred to his mind. "The cavalry go into battle, meet the wounded on their way, give them a wink as they pass, and never for a moment think of what awaits them. And 20,000 of them are doomed to die, yet they can wonder at my hat." Strange, thought Pierre, as he went on to Tatarinovo. In front of a landowner's house, on the left of the road, stood carriages, wagons, and a crowd of orderlies and sentinels. This was where the commander-in-chief was putting up, but when Pierre arrived, he was not in, and almost none of the staff was there. They had all gone to a church service. Pierre drove on toward Gorky. Driving up the hill into the little village street, he saw for the first time the peasants of the militia, wearing white shirts and caps with crosses on them. Loudly talking and laughing, the perspiring men were eagerly at work on a huge knoll overgrown with grass to the right of the road. Some were digging, some wheeling barrow-loads of earth along planks, while others stood about doing nothing. Two officers were standing on the knoll, directing the men. Seeing these peasants, who were evidently still amused by the novelty of their position as soldiers, Pierre was again reminded of the wounded men at Mojezk, and he understood what the soldier had tried to express when he had said, "They mean to throw the whole nation against them." The sight of these bearded peasants at work on the battlefield, with their queer, clumsy boots, their perspiring necks, here and there with shirts unbuttoned obliquely across their chests, exposing their sunburned collarbones, impressed Pierre with the solemnity and an importance of the moment more forcibly than anything he had yet seen or heard.
This is Ernest Leo Grandi of the New York Daily News. I'll be reading from pages 915 to 919. Pierre got out of his carriage and, walking past the toiling militiamen, climbed up onto the knoll from which the doctor had told him he could see the battlefield. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. The sun was a little to the left, and behind him, and in the clear, rarefied atmosphere, the vast panorama that opened like an amphitheater before him was brilliantly illuminated. Above and to the left, the Smolensk Highway intersected this amphitheater, passing through a village with a white church some 500 yards in front of and below the knoll. This was Borodino. Near the village, the road crossed the river by a bridge, and, winding uphill and down, rose higher and higher to the hamlet of Valuyevo, where Napoleon now was, which was visible 6 versts away. Beyond Valuyevo, the road disappeared into a yellowing forest on the horizon. In this forest of birch and spruce, to the right of the road, the cross and belfry of the Klotsky Monastery gleamed in the sun from the distance. Over the whole of that blue expanse, smoking campfires and indistinct masses of troops, ours and the enemy's, could be intermittently seen on both sides of the forest and road. The terrain to the right, along the course of the Kolocha and Moskva rivers, was gullied and hilly. Through the gaps between hills, the villages of Betsubovo and Zakharino were visible in the distance. On the left, the terrain was more level. There were fields of grain, and the smoking ruins of the village of Semyonovsk could be seen. All that Pierre saw to the right and left of him was so indefinite that no part of the scene before his eyes satisfied his expectations. Nowhere was there a battlefield such as he had imagined, but only meadows, woods, glades, troops, the smoke of campfires, villages, knolls, and streams. Try as he would, he could descry no military position in this landscape teeming with life, and could not even distinguish our troops from the enemy's. I must ask someone who knows, he thought, and addressed an officer who was gazing with curiosity at his huge, unmilitary figure. May I ask you, said Pierre, what village that is down there? Borodino, isn't it? The officer asked his companion. Borodino, the other corrected him. The officer, evidently glad of an opportunity to talk, moved nearer to Pierre. Are those our men there? Asked Pierre. Yes, and there, farther on, are the French, said the officer. There they are, you can see them. Where? Asked Pierre. You can see them with the naked eye. Look there. The officer pointed to the smoke rising on the left beyond the river, and the same stern, serious expression appeared on his face that Pierre had seen on the faces of many of the men he had encountered. Ah, so those are the French. And over there? Pierre pointed to a mound on the left near which some troops could be seen. Those are ours. Oh, they are. And over there? Pierre pointed to another knoll in the distance with a big tree on it, not far from a village that lay in a hollow where more campfires were smoking and something black was discernible. That's his again, said the officer. It was a Shevardino redoubt. Yesterday it was ours, but now it's his. Then how about our position? Our position, repeated the officer with a smile of satisfaction. I can tell you quite clearly, because I constructed almost all our fortifications. There, you see, that's our center at Borodino, right over there. He pointed to the village with a white church directly in front of them. There's where we crossed the Kolocha. You see down there, where the rows of mown hay are lying in the hollow? The bridge is there. That's our center. Our right flank is over there. He pointed to the extreme right, to a distant ravine. That's where the river Moskva is, And we have thrown up three redoubts there, very strong ones. Our left flank, here the officer paused. Well, you know, that's difficult to explain. Yesterday, our left flank was over there at Shevardino, you see, where that oak is. But now we have withdrawn our left wing. Now it's over there. Do you see that village in the smoke? That's Semyonovsk. Yes, right there. He pointed to Rayevsky's knoll. But the battle will hardly be there. His moving his troops there is only a stratagem. He will probably go around to the right of the Moskva. But wherever it may be, there'll be many a man missing tomorrow, said the officer. An elderly sergeant had approached the officer while he was giving these explanations and had waited for him to finish speaking. But at this point, evidently displeased by his last remark, interrupted him. Gabions must be sent for, he sternly announced. The officer seemed disconcerted, as though realizing that one might think about how many men would be missing next day, but ought not to speak of it. Well, send number three company again, replied hurriedly. And who are you? Are you one of the doctors? No, I'm not anything, answered Pierre, and he went down the hill, again passing the militiamen. Oh, those damn fellows, muttered the officer who followed him, holding his nose as he passed the men at work. There they are. They're bringing her. They're coming. There they are. They'll be here in a minute, voices were suddenly heard saying. And officers, soldiers, and militiamen began running forward along the road. A church procession was coming up the hill from Borodino. First along the dusty road came the infantry, marching in formation, bareheaded and trailing arms. From behind them came the sound of church singing. Soldiers and militiamen ran bareheaded past Pierre to meet the procession. They are bringing her, our defender, the Iberian Mother of God, someone cried. The Smolensk Mother of God, another corrected him. The militiamen, both those who had been in the village and those who had been at work on the battery, having thrown down their spades, ran to meet the procession. Behind the battalion, marching along the dusty road, came the priests in their vestments, one little old man and a cow with attendants and choristers. Behind them, soldiers and officers bore a large, dark-faced icon with an embossed metal cover. This was the icon that had been brought from Smolensk and had since accompanied the army. Before, behind, and all around the icon, crowds of soldiers with bared heads walked, ran, and bowed to the ground. When they reached the top of the hill, they stopped. The men who had been holding up the icon by the linen bands attached to it were relieved by others. The chanters relit the censers, and the service began. The hot rays of the sun beat down vertically. A faint, fresh breeze played with the hair of the bared heads and fluttered the ribbons decorating the icon. The singing sounded subdued under the open sky. An immense crowd of bareheaded officers, soldiers, and militiamen surrounded the icon. In a place apart, behind the priest and chanter, were gathered the persons of rank. A bald general with the Order of St. George hanging from his neck stood just behind the priest, and, not crossing himself, he was evidently a German, patiently waited for the end of the service, which he probably considered a necessary means of arousing the patriotism of the Russian people. Another general stood in a martial pose, looking about him and making quick little signs of the cross in front of his chest. Pierre, standing in the crowd of peasants, recognized several acquaintances among the officials, but he did not look at them. His whole attention was absorbed in watching the serious expressions on the faces of the soldiers and militiamen, all of whom were gazing raptly at the icon. As soon as the weary chanters, who were repeating the service for the 20th time that day, listlessly and mechanically began to sing, "Save from calamity thy servants, O Mother of God," and the priest and deacon chimed in, "For to thee, under God, we all flee as to an everlasting bulwark and protection," every face lighted up with the same expression of awareness of the solemnity of the impending moment that Pierre had seen on the faces of the men at the foot of the hill at Mozaysk, and fleetingly among those he had encountered that morning. And heads were bowed more frequently and hair tossed back, and there were sounds of the men sighing and tapping their breasts as they crossed themselves. The crowd around the icon suddenly parted and pressed against Pierre. Someone, a very important personage to judge by the haste with which they made way for him, was approaching the icon. It was Kutuzov, who had been making a tour of the position. On his way back to Tatarinovo, he had stopped where the service was being held. Pierre instantly recognized him by his peculiar figure, which distinguished him from everyone else. Wearing a long overcoat over his enormously stout, round-shouldered body, his uncovered white head exposing the puffy face and injured eye, Kutuzov advanced with his plunging, swaying gait into the ring and stopped behind the priest. He crossed himself with an accustomed gesture, bent down till his hand touched the ground, then, with a deep sigh, bowed his gray head. Behind Kutuzov was Bennigsen and the suite. Despite the presence of the commander-in-chief, which drew the attention of all the superior officers, the soldiers and the militiamen went on praying without looking at him. When the service was over, Kutuzov went up to the icon, sank heavily to his knees, and bowed to the ground. For a long time, he tried in vain to rise, but was hindered by his weakness and weight. His gray head twitched with the effort. At last, he rose, put out his lips in a naive, childlike way, and kissed the icon, and again bowed down and touched the ground with his hand. The other generals followed his example. Then the officers, soldiers, and militiamen pressed forward, pushing and jostling one another, breathless with excitement. This was Ernest Leo Grandi of the New York Daily News. I read from pages 915 to 919.
This is Kathy Dobkin. I'm co-producer of the War and Peace Project for WBAI, and I'm recording from the ladies' room on East 62nd Street. I'll be reading pages 919 through 923 of War and Peace. Caught up in the throng and carried along with it, Pierre looked about him. Count, Pyotr Kirillovich. How did you get here? Someone cried. Pierre looked around. Boris Trubetskoy, brushing his knees with his hand, he too had probably knelt before the icon, came up to Pierre smiling. Boris was elegantly dressed, with just a suggestion of the campaigner. He wore a long coat and, like Kutuzov, had a riding whip slung over his shoulder. Meanwhile, Kutuzov had reached the village and seated himself in the shade of the nearest house on a bench that one Cossack ran to fetch and another hastily covered with a rug. An immense and brilliant suite surrounded the commander-in-chief. The icon, accompanied by the throng, was carried farther on its way. Pierre stopped some 30 paces from Kutuzov and talked to Boris. He explained his intention of being present at the battle and surveying the position. This is what you must do, said Boris. I'll do the honors of the camp. You will see everything best from where Count Bennigsen will be. I am in attendance on him, you know. I'll mention it to him. And if you'd like to make a tour of the position, come along with us. We are just going to the left flank, and then when we get back, I hope you will spend the night with us, and we'll arrange a game of cards. You know Dmitry Sergeyevich, of course. Those are his quarters, and he pointed to the third house in Gorky. But I should have liked to see the right flank. I'm told it is very strong, said Pierre. I'd like to start from the Moskva River and ride around the whole position. Well, you can do that later, but the left flank is the chief thing. Yes, yes, and where is Prince Bolkonsky's regiment? Can you point it out to me? Asked Pierre. Andrei Nikolaevich's? We shall pass it, and I'll take you to him. What were you saying about the left flank? Asked Pierre. To tell you the truth, entre nous, there is no way of telling how things stand with the left flank, said Boris, lowering his voice and speaking confidentially. It's not at all what Count Bennigsen had intended. He meant to fortify that knoll over there quite differently, but... Boris shrugged his shoulders. His Serene Highness would not have it, or someone talked him out of it. You see, Boris did not finish, for at that moment, Kutuzov's adjutant, Kaisarov, came up to Pierre. Ah, Paisy Sergeyevich, said Boris, turning to him with an offhand smile. I was just trying to explain our position to the Count. It's amazing how His Serene Highness could so accurately foresee the plans of the French. You mean about the left flank? Asked Kaisarov. Yes, yes, precisely. That left flank of ours is now exceedingly strong. Though Kutuzov had dismissed all superfluous personnel from the staff, Boris had contrived to remain at headquarters after the change. He was attached to Count Bennigsen, who, like everyone under whom Boris had served, considered young Prince Drubetskoy an invaluable man. There were two sharply defined parties in the high command, Kutuzov's party and that of Bennigsen, the chief of staff. Boris belonged to the latter faction, and no one knew better than he how to show a fawning respect to Kutuzov, while at the same time creating the impression that the old man was not much good and that it was Bennigsen who managed everything. Now the decisive moment of battle was at hand, which was to result either in the downfall of Kutuzov and the transfer of power to Bennigsen, or, even if Kutuzov were to win the battle, the general impression that everything had been done by Bennigsen. In any case, many important rewards would be made after tomorrow's action, and new men would be brought to the fore. Consequently, Boris was in a state of nervous exhilaration all that day. After Kaisarov, several other acquaintances came up to Pierre, and he had not time to reply to all the questions about Moscow that were showered upon him, or to listen to all the tales they had to tell him. Every face wore a look of excitement and apprehension, but it seemed to Pierre that the cause of the excitement, expressed by some of the faces, lay chiefly in the questions of personal success, and he could not get out of his mind a very different expression of excitement that he had seen on other faces, and which spoke not of personal considerations, but of universal questions of life and death. Kutuzov caught sight of Pierre's figure in the midst of the group gathered around him. "Call him to me," he said. Having been informed of His Serene Highness's wish by an adjutant, Pierre went toward Kutuzov's bench, but a militiaman got there before him. It was Dolokhov. "How did that fellow get here?" asked Pierre. "He's such a sly dog, he worms his way in everywhere," was the answer Pierre received. "He was degraded to the ranks, you know, and now he's trying to bounce up again. He's been proposing some scheme or other, and at night goes crawling up to the enemy's front line. He's got courage." Pierre took off his hat and bowed respectfully to Kutuzov. "I decided that if I reported to your Serene Highness, you might send me away or say that you already knew what I had to tell you. But then, I have nothing to lose," Dolokhov was saying. "Quite right, quite right. And if I were right, I should be rendering a service to my fatherland, for which I am ready to die." "Quite right, quite right. And if your Serene Highness has need of a man who doesn't mind risking his skin, please think of me. Perhaps I might be of use to your Highness." "Quite right, quite right," repeated Kutuzov, looking at Pierre with a narrowed, laughing eye. Meanwhile, Boris, with the adroitness of a courtier, moved to Pierre's side, near Kutuzov, and in the most natural manner, without raising his voice, and as though continuing a conversation, said, "The militiamen have put on clean white shirts to be ready to die. What heroism, Count." Boris said this to Pierre with the manifest intention of being overheard by His Serene Highness. He knew that Kutuzov's attention would be caught by the remark, and so it was. "What are you saying about the militia?" he asked Boris. "They're preparing for tomorrow, Your Serene Highness, for death. They've put on clean white shirts." "Ah, a wonderful, incomparable people," said Kutuzov, closing his eyes and wagging his head. "An incomparable people," he repeated with a sigh. "So, you want to smell gunpowder," he said to Pierre. "Yes, it's a pleasant smell. I have the honor to be one of your wife's adorers. Is she well?" "My quarters are at your disposal." And as often happens with old people, Kutuzov began looking about absent-mindedly, as if he had forgotten what he had to say or do. Then, apparently remembering what he wanted, he beckoned to Andrei Sergeyevich Kaisarov, his adjutant's brother. "Those verses, those vertins of Marin's, how do they go, eh? The lines he wrote about Gerakov? Thou preceptor to the core..." Recite them, he said, obviously prepared to laugh. Kaisarov recited the lines. Kutuzov smiled and nodded his head in rhythm to the verses. When Pierre left Kutuzov, Dolokhov came up to him and took his hand. I am very glad to meet you here, Count, he said in a loud voice, disregarding the presence of strangers, and with marked determination and solemnity. On the eve of a day when God knows who among us is destined to survive, I am glad to have the opportunity of telling you how sorry I am for the misunderstandings that occurred between us, and that I hope you harbor no ill feelings toward me. I beg you to forgive me. Pierre looked at Dolokhov with a smile, not knowing what to say to him. With tears in his eyes, Dolokhov embraced Pierre and kissed him. Boris said something to his general, and Count Bennigsen turned to Pierre and proposed that he should ride with them along the line. You will find it interesting, he said. Yes, most interesting, replied Pierre. Half an hour later, Kutuzov was on his way back to Tatarinova, and Boris and his suite, with Pierre among them, set out on their tour of the line. Recording from the ladies' room at WBAI, this has been Kathy Dobkin, co-producer of the War and Peace Project, reading pages 919 through 923.
This is William F. Buckley, Jr., reading pages 923 to 934. From Gorky, Bennigsen descended the highway to the bridge that the officer on the knoll had pointed out to Pierre as the center of opposition, and where rows of fragrant new-mown hay lay by the riverside. They crossed the bridge and rode into the village of Borodino, then turned to the left, and, passing a tremendous number of men and cannons, came out on a high knoll on which militiamen were at work digging. This was the redoubt, as yet unnamed, that later became known as the Raevsky Redoubt, or the Knoll Battery. Pierre paid no special attention to this mound. He did not know that it was to be for him the most memorable spot on the whole plain of Borodino. They crossed the ravine to Sedmyonovsk, where soldiers were dragging away the beams of huts and barns. Then, riding uphill and down, crossing a field of rye trampled and beaten down as if by hail, and along a track newly made by the artillery over the furrows of plowed land, they reached some flesh that was still being dug. Bennigsen stopped at the flesh and began looking at the Severodino redoubt opposite, which had been ours the day before, and where several horsemen could be descried. The officer said that either Napoleon or Murat was there. All peered eagerly at the little group of horsemen. A peer, too, gazed at them, trying to guess which of the scarcely discernible figures was Napoleon. At last, the horsemen descended the hill and disappeared from sight. Bennigsen turned to a general who approached him and commenced explaining the entire position of our troops. Pierre listened, straining all his faculties to grasp the essential points of the impending battle, but to his chagrin felt that his mental powers were not equal to the task. He could make nothing of it. Bennigsen stopped speaking and, noticing that Pierre was listening, said to him, "I don't imagine this is very interesting for you." "Oh, on the contrary, it's most interesting," said Pierre, not quite truthfully. From the flesh, they rode still further to the left, along a road that wound through a low, dense birch forest. In the middle of the wood, a brown hare with white pads bounded out and, scared by the horse's hoofbeats, grew so confused that it hopped along the road in front of them for some time, drawing general attention and arousing laughter. Only when several of the men shouted, as it did, it darted to one side and disappeared in a thicket. After going through the wood for about two versts, they came out on a clearing where troops of Tuchot's corps were stationed to defend the left flank. Here, at the extreme left flank, Bennigsen talked volubly and heatedly, and, as it seemed to Pierre, gave orders of great military importance. In front of Tuchot's troops was an eminence which was not occupied by troops. Bennigsen loudly criticized his mistake, saying that it was madness to leave an elevation that commanded the surrounding country unoccupied and to place troops below it. Several of the generals expressed the same opinion. One in particular declared with martial vehemence that they were put there to be slaughtered. Bennigsen, on his own authority, ordered the troops to move up to the height. This disposition on the left flank made Pierre more than ever doubtful of his capacity to comprehend military matters. As he listened to Bennigsen and the other generals criticizing the position of the troops at the foot of the hill, He quite understood them and shared their opinion, but for that very reason could not imagine how the man who had placed them there could have made so gross and palpable a blunder. Pierre could not know that these troops had been stationed in a concealed spot as an ambush, that being unseen, they might strike a sudden blow at the approaching enemy. Bennigsen, unaware of this, moved the troops forward according to his own ideas and said nothing about it to the commander-in-chief. On that bright evening of August 25th, Prince Andrei lay propped on his elbow in a tumble-down shed in the village of Knyatskovo, at the far end of his regiment's encampment. Through a gap in the broken wall, he was looking along the fence at a row of 30-year-old birches with their lower branches lopped off, at a field on which shocks of oats were standing, and at the bushes near which rose the smoke of campfires, the soldiers' field kitchens. Narrow and useless and burdensome as his life now seemed to him, Prince Andrei nevertheless felt as agitated and irritable on the eve of battle as he had felt 7 years before at Austerlitz. He had received and issued orders for the next day's battle. He had nothing to do, but his thoughts, which were of the simplest, clearest, and therefore most dreadful sort, would give him no peace. He knew that tomorrow's battle would be the most terrible of all he had ever taken part in, and for the first time in his life the possibility of death presented himself to him, not in relation to his earthly life or to any consideration of the effect of his death on others, but simply in relation to himself, to his own soul, plainly, vividly, horrifically, and almost as a certainty. And from the height of this perception, all that had previously tormented and preoccupied him was suddenly illumined by a cold, white light, without shadows, without perspective, without distinction of outline. All life appeared to him like magic lantern pictures at which he had long been gazing through a glass by artificial light. Now he suddenly saw those badly daubed pictures in clear daylight and without the glass. Yes, yes, there they are, those false images which agitated, enthralled, and tormented me, he said to himself, passing in review the principal pictures of the magic lantern of life, and looking at them now in the cold, white daylight of his clear perception of death. There they are, those crudely painted figures that once seemed splendid and mysterious, glory, the commonweal, love for a woman, the fatherland itself. How grand those pictures appeared to me, and with what profound meaning they seemed to be filled. And it is all so simple, colorless and crude, in the cold, white light of the morning that I feel is dawning for me. The three great sorrows of his life particularly held his attention: his love for a woman, the death of his father, and the invasion by the French, which had made inroads upon half of Russia. Love, that young girl who seemed to be brimming with mystic forces, how I loved her. I made romantic plans of love and happiness with her. Oh, what a nice little boy I was, he bitterly exclaimed aloud. To be sure, I believed in some sort of ideal love that was to keep her faithful to me for the entire year of my absence. Like the gentle dove of the fable, she was to pine away, parted from me, but it was also very much simpler, so horribly simple and revolting. My father, too, built bald hills, and thought it was his place, his land, his air, his peasants. But Napoleon came and swept him aside, unaware of his existence, as he might brush a chip from his path. And his bald hills and his whole life fell to pieces. Princess Maria says it is a trial sent from above. What is this trial? For when he is no longer here, and never will be, never, he is no more. For whom then is this trial? The fatherland, the destruction of Moscow? And tomorrow I shall be killed, perhaps not even by a Frenchman, but by one of our own men, like the soldier who fired his gun close to my ear yesterday. and the French will come along and take me by the head and heels and pitch me into a hole that I may not stink under their noses, and new conditions of life will arise which will seem quite ordinary to others, and I shall not know about them, for I shall not exist. He gazed at the row of birches with their motionless green and yellow foliage and white bark gleaming the sun. To die, to be killed tomorrow, to be no more, that all this should still exist, and I not be. He pictured the world without himself. The birches with their light and shade, the fleecy clouds, the smoke of the campfires. Everything around him underwent a sudden transformation and seemed to him sinister and menacing. A cold shiver ran down his spine. He quickly rose, went out, and began walking up and down. When he returned to the shed, he heard a voice outside. "Who's there?" Prince Andrei called. The red-nosed Captain Timohin, formerly Dolohov's company commander, and now, from a lack of officers, battalion commander, shyly entered the shed, following by an adjutant and the regimental paymaster. Prince Andrei quickly stood up, listened to the business they had come about, gave some further orders, and was about to dismiss them when he heard a familiar lisping voice outside the shed. "Que diable!" said the voice of a man stumbling over something. Prince Andrei looked out of the shed and saw Pierre, who had tripped over a stake lying on the ground and had almost fallen. Prince Andrei generally disliked seeing people from his own circle, and especially Pierre, who reminded him of all the painful moments he had endured on his last visit to Moscow. "Well, what a surprise," he said. "What brings you here? I never expected to see you here." As he said this, his eyes and the whole expression of his face was more than cold. It was positively hostile, as Pierre instantly noticed. He had approached the shed with the greatest eagerness, but when he saw Prince Andrei's face, he felt constrained and ill at ease. "I came, well, you know, it interested me," said Pierre, who had senselessly repeated the word interesting so many times that day. "I wanted to see the battle." "Oh, yes, and what do your brother Masons say about the war? How would they prevent it?" said Prince Andrei sarcastically. "Well, and how is Moscow and my people? Have they reached Moscow at last?" he asked seriously. "Yes, they have. Julie Drubetskaya told me they had arrived. I went to call but missed them. They have gone to your estate near Moscow." The officers were about to retire, but Prince Andrei, apparently reluctant to be left alone with his friend, asked them to stay and have tea. Benches were set out and tea was brought in. The officers, not without certain astonishment, stared at Pierre's huge, stout figure as they listened to his talk of Moscow and the disposition of our forces, around which he had succeeded in making a tour. Prince Andrei remained silent, and his expression was so forbidding that Pierre addressed himself more to Timohin, the good-natured battalion commander, than to Balkansky. "So you understand the whole disposition of our troops?" Prince Andrei interrupted him. "Yes, that is. How do you mean?" Asked Pierre. "Not being a military man, I can't say I do entirely, but at least I understand the general plan." "Well, then, you know more than anyone else," observed Prince Andrei in French. "Oh," said Pierre, looking over his spectacles in perplexity at Prince Andrei. "Well, and what do you think of Kutuzov's appointment?" he asked. "I welcomed his appointment. More than that, I cannot say," replied Prince Andrei. "And tell me, what is your opinion of Barclay de Tolly? In Moscow, they are saying heaven knows what about him. What do you think of him?" "Ask them," replied Prince Andrei, indicating the officers. Pierre looked at Timohin with the quizzical, condescending smile with which everyone involuntarily addressed him. "It was a gleam of serene light in the darkness, Your Excellency, when His Serene Highness took over," said Timohin, continually darting shy glances at his colonel. "Why is that?" asked Pierre. "Well, to speak only of firewood and fodder, let me tell you. Why, when we were retreating from Switchyany, we didn't dare to touch a stick of wood, a wisp of hay, or anything. And you see, with us leaving, he would get it all." Isn't that right, Your Excellency? He said, turning again to his prince. We didn't dare. Two of our officers were court-martialed for that kind of thing. Well, since His Serene Highness took command, everything became quite simple as far as this is concerned. Now we see light. Then why had it been forbidden? Timoheen looked about in confusion, at a loss to know how to answer such a question. Pierre put the same question to Prince Andrei. Why, so as not to lay waste the country we were abandoning to the enemy, said Prince Andrei with venomous sarcasm. That is very sound. One cannot allow pillage and accustom the troops to marauding. At Smolensk, too, he very correctly judged that the French might outflank us and that they had larger forces. But he could not understand this, cried Prince Andrei in a shrill voice that seemed beyond his control. He could not understand that there, for the first time, we were fighting for Russian soil, that there was a spirit in the men such as I have never seen before, that for two consecutive days we had repulsed the French, and that this success had increased our strength tenfold. He ordered us to retreat, and all our efforts and losses went for nothing. He had no thought of betraying us. He was doing the best he could and had thought out everything beforehand, but that is exactly why he is unsuited. He is unsuited now just because he considers everything very thoroughly and precisely as every German is bound to do. How can I explain? Well, say your father has a German valet, and he's an excellent valet, and satisfies all your father's requirements better than you could, and all's well and good. But if your father is mortally ill, you'll send away the valet and attend to your father with your own clumsy, unpracticed hands, and you will be more comfort to him than a skilled man who is a stranger could be. So it has been with Barclay. While Russia was well, a foreigner could serve her and be an excellent minister. But as soon as she is in danger, she needs one of her own kin. But in your club, they make him out a traitor. The only result of vilifying him now as a traitor will be that later on, ashamed of their false accusations, they will suddenly make him out a hero or a genius, which will be still more unjust. He is an honest and very punctilious German. They do say he's a skilled commander. I don't know what is meant by a skilled commander, retorted Prince Andrei derisively. A skilled commander, began Pierre, well, it's one who foresees all contingencies and well divines the enemy's intentions. But that is impossible, said Prince Andrei, as if it were a matter that had been settled long ago. Pierre looked at him in surprise. And yet, isn't it said that war is like a game of chess? Yes, replied Prince Andrei, but with the slight difference that in chess you can think over each move as long as you please, unrestricted by conditions of time, and with the further difference that a knight is always stronger than a pawn, and two pawns are always stronger than one, while in war a battalion is sometimes stronger than a division and sometimes weaker than a company. No one can ever be certain of the relative strength of armies. You may be sure, he continued, that if things depended on arrangements made by the staff, I should be there making those arrangements, instead of which I have the honor of serving here in the regiment with these gentlemen, and I consider that tomorrow's battle, in fact, will depend on us rather than on them. Success never has and never will depend on position or equipment or even on numbers, least of all on position. On what then? On the feeling that is in me and in him, he pointed to Timoheen, and in every soldier. Prince Andrei glanced at Timoheen, who was staring at his commander in bewilderment and dismay. In contrast to his former reticence and taciturnity, Prince Andrei now seemed excited. Apparently he could not refrain from expressing the thoughts that had suddenly occurred to him. A battle is won by the side that has firmly resolved to win it. Why did we lose the Battle of Austerlitz? The French losses were almost equal to ours, but very early in the day we said to ourselves that we were losing the battle, so we lost it. And we said so because there we had nothing to fight for. We simply wanted to quit the battlefield as soon as possible. We've lost. Let's run. And we ran. If we had not said that till evening, God knows what might have happened. But tomorrow we shan't say it. You talk about our position. The left flank weak, the right flank extended, he went on. That's all nonsense. Doesn't mean a thing. But what are we facing tomorrow? 100 million diverse chances which will be decided on the instant by whether we run or they run.
WBAI, New York.
Whether this man or that man is killed. But all that's being done at this moment is mere pastime. The fact is that those men with whom you rode around inspecting the position not only do not help matters, but hinder them. They are only concerned with their own petty interests. At such a moment, said Pierre in a tone of disapprobation, at such a moment, Prince Andrei repeated. For them, it is only a moment to undermine a rival and get an extra cross or ribbon. For me, what tomorrow means is this. 100,000 French troops and 100,000 Russian troops have come together to fight. And the fact is that these 200,000 men will fight. And the side that fights more fiercely and spares itself least will conquer. And if you like, I can tell you that whatever happens and whatever mess those at the top may make, we shall win tomorrow's battle. Tomorrow, happen what may, we shall win the battle. You're right, Your Excellency. Absolutely right, declared Timohin. Who would spare himself now? The soldiers in my battalion, believe me, wouldn't touch their vodka. This is not the time for it, they say. All were silent. The officers rose. Prince Andrei went out of the shed with them, giving the adjutant his final orders. After the officers had gone, Pierre moved nearer to Prince Andrei and was about to start a conversation when they heard the hoofbeats of three horses on the road not far from the shed. And looking in that direction, Prince Andrei recognized Wolzogen and Clausewitz, accompanied by a Cossack. As they rode by, Pierre and Prince Andrei could not help overhearing a fragment of their conversation. But the war must be extended over a broader area. That is a view which I cannot recommend too highly, one of them was saying in German. Most certainly, replied the other. Since the aim is to weaken the enemy, one cannot, of course, take into account loss of civilian lives. Certainly not. Extended over a broader area, repeated Prince Andrei with an angry snort when they had ridden by. In that broader area. I had a father and a son and a sister at Bald Hills. But it's all the same to him. That's what I was saying to you. Those German gentlemen won't win the battle tomorrow, but will only make a filthy mess of it insofar as they can, because they have nothing in their German heads but theories which are not worth a straw, and their hearts lack the one thing needed for tomorrow, what Timohin has. They have yielded up all Europe to him and now have come to teach us, fine teachers. And again his voice grew shrill. So you think that tomorrow's battle will be won by us? Asked Pierre. Yes, yes, replied Prince Andrei absently. One thing I would establish if I had the power, he began again. I would not take prisoners. Why take prisoners? That's chivalry. The French have destroyed my home and are on their way to destroy Moscow. They have outraged and continue to outrage me every instant. They are my enemies. In my opinion, they are all criminals, and that's exactly what Timohin and the entire army think. They should be executed. Since they are my enemies, they cannot be my friends, whatever may have been said at Tilsit. Yes, yes, murmured Pierre, gazing at Prince Andrei with shining eyes. I absolutely agree with you. Absolutely. The question that had troubled Pierre on the Mohaisk Hill and all that day now seemed to him quite clear and fully solved. Now he understood the whole meaning and importance of this war and of the impending battle. All he had seen that day, all the significant, stern expressions on the faces he had glimpsed in passing, appeared to him in a new light. He understood that suppressed, latent, as they say in physics, heat of patriotism in all those men he had seen, and it explained to him the composure and ostensible lightheartedness with which they faced death. "Not to take prisoners," Prince Andrei continued. "That alone would change the whole war and make it less cruel. As it is, we have been playing at war. That is what's so vile. Acting chivalrous and all the rest of it. Such magnanimity and sensibility are like that of a lady who faints at the sight of a slaughtered calf. She is so kind-hearted she can't bear the sight of blood, but she eats the fricasseed veal with gusto. They're forever harping on the rules of warfare, on chivalry, on flags of truth, on mercy to the victims, and so on is all rubbish. I saw chivalry and flags of truth in 1805. They gulled us and we gulled them. They plunder people's homes, issue counterfeit money, and worst of all, they kill our children and our fathers. And then they talk of the rules of war and of magnanimity to the foe. No prisoners, I say. Kill and be killed. Anyone who has arrived at this through the same sufferings as I have." Prince Andrei, who had thought it was a matter of indifference to him whether or not they took Moscow as they had taken Smolensk, was suddenly checked by a contraction of the throat. He paced up and down several times in silence, but his eyes glittered feverishly and his lips quivered when he began to speak again. "If there were none of this chivalry in war, we should go to war only when it was worth going to certain death, as now. Then there would not be wars merely because Pavel Ivanich had insulted Mikhail Ivanich. And if there was a war like this one, it would be a war, and the intensity of the troops would be quite different. Then all these Westphalians and Hessians Napoleon is leading against us would not have followed into Russia, nor should we have gone to fight in Austria and Prussia without knowing why. War is not a polite recreation, but the vilest thing in life, and we ought to realize this and not make a game of it. We ought to take this terrible necessity soberly and seriously. It all comes to this. Eliminate the humbug and let war be war, not a game. As it is now, it's the favorite pastime of the idle and the frivolous. The military class is the most highly honored. And what is war? What is required for success in warfare? What are the moral standards of the military world? The aim of war is murder. The implements of warfare, espionage, treachery, and the inducements thereto, the ruination of a country's inhabitants by ravage and robbery to provision the army, the trickery and deceit known as military stratagems, the ethics of the military class, lack of freedom, in other words, discipline, idleness, ignorance, cruelty, debauchery, and drunkenness. Yet, in spite of all this, it is the highest class, respected by all. Every sovereign except the Chinese wears a military uniform and bestows the greatest rewards on those who kill the most people. They meet, as we shall meet tomorrow, to murder one another. They kill and maim tens of thousands of men and then hold Thanksgiving services for having slaughtered so many. They even exaggerate the number and proclaim a victory, assuming that the greater the slaughter, the greater the merit. How God can look down and hear them, cried Prince Andrei in a shrill, piercing voice. Ah, my friend, life has become a burden for me of late. I see that I have begun to understand too much. It does not do for a man to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Ah, well, it's not for long, he added. However, you are sleepy, and it's time for me to turn in. Go back to Gorky, said Prince Andrei suddenly. Oh, no, responded Pierre, looking at Prince Andrei with eyes full of compassion and dismay. Yes, you must go. Before a battle, one needs to get a good night's sleep, said Prince Andrei. He quickly went up to Pierre and embraced and kissed him. Goodbye, go now, he cried. Whether we shall meet again or not, and hastily turned away, he went into the shed. It was now dark, and Pierre could not make out whether the expression on Prince Andrei's face was angry or tender. For some time he stood in silence, wondering whether to follow him or to go away. No, he does not want that, Pierre decided. But I know this is our last meeting. He heaved a deep sigh and rode back to Gorky. In the shed, Prince Andrei lay down on a rug, but he could not sleep. He closed his eyes. One set of images followed another in his imagination. On one of them, he dwelt long and happily. He vividly recalled a certain evening in Petersburg. Natasha, with a vivacious, excited expression, was telling him about how she had gone to hunt for mushrooms the previous summer and had lost her way in the great forest. Incoherently describing to him the dense forest, her sensations, her talk with a beekeeper she met, she continually interrupted her story to say, "No, I can't. I'm not telling it properly. No, you don't understand." Although Prince Andrei tried to reassure her by telling her that he did understand, and he suddenly had understood everything she was trying to tell him. But Natasha had been dissatisfied with her own words. She felt that they did not convey the passionately poetic feelings he had experienced that day, which she wanted to recreate. He was such a charming old man, and it was so dark in the forest, and he had such a kind... "No, I can't describe it," she had said, flushed with emotion. Prince Andrei smiled now the same happy smile as then, when he had looked into her eyes. "I understood her," he thought. "I not only understood her, but it was just that spiritual force, that sincerity, that open-heartedness, that soul of hers which seemed inseparable from her body. It was that soul I loved in her, loved so intensely, so happily." And suddenly, he recalled what it was that had put an end to his love. He cared nothing for all that. He neither saw nor understood anything of the sort. All he saw was a pretty, fresh young girl with whom he did not deign to link his destiny. And he is still alive and enjoying life. Prince Andrei jumped up as though he had been scalded and commenced pacing up and down in front of the shed. This is William F. Buckley, Jr., pages 923 to 934.
This is Joe Gelmis, movie critic for Newsday and a producer of the movies for WBAI. I'll be reading War and Peace, Book 3, Part 2, chapters 26 to 27, pages 934 to 941. On the 25th of August, the eve of the Battle of Borodino, Monsieur de Beausset, prefect of the French Emperor's Palace, and Colonel Favier arrived at Napoleon's headquarters at Valjevo, the former from Paris, the latter from Madrid. After changing into court uniform, Monsieur de Beausset ordered a box he had brought for the Emperor to be carried before him, and walked into the outer compartment of Napoleon's tent, where he busied himself opening the box while conversing with Napoleon's aides-de-camp who surrounded him. Favier remained outside the tent, talking to some generals of his acquaintance. The Emperor Napoleon had not yet left his bedroom and was finishing his toilet. Uttering little snorts and grunts, he presented first his back, then his plump, hairy chest to the brush with which his valet was rubbing him down. Another valet, with his finger over the mouth of a bottle, was sprinkling eau de cologne on the Emperor's pampered body with an expression which seemed to say that he alone knew where and how much eau de cologne should be applied. Napoleon's short hair was wet and matted on his forehead. His face, though puffy and yellow, expressed physical satisfaction. "Go on, harder, keep it up," he muttered to the valet who was rubbing him as he grunted and tensed his body. An aide-de-camp who had come in to report to the Emperor the number of prisoners taken in the previous day's action was standing at the door after delivering his message, waiting for permission to withdraw. Napoleon looked up at him from under his brows, scowling. "No prisoners," he said, repeating the aide-de-camp's words. "They are forcing us to exterminate them. So much the worse for the Russian army." "Go on, harder," he muttered, hunching his back and presenting his fat shoulders to the valet. "All right, let Monsieur de Beausset come in, and Favier, too," he said, nodding to his aide-de-camp. Yes, sire, replied the aide-de-camp, and disappeared through the door of the tent. The two valets quickly dressed His Majesty, and wearing the blue uniform of the guards, Napoleon entered the reception room with a brisk, firm step. Meanwhile, de Bussy had been busily arranging on two chairs directly in front of the entrance the gift he had brought from the Empress. But Napoleon had dressed and come in with such unexpected dispatch that he had not time to finish preparing the surprise. Napoleon at once noticed what they were about and guessed that they were not ready for him. He did not want to deprive them of the pleasure of preparing a surprise for him, so he pretended not to see de Bussy and called Favier to him. He listened in silence and with a stern frown as Favier told him of the courage and devotion of his troops at the other end of Europe, fighting at Salamanca, with but one thought, to be worthy of their emperor, and but one fear, failure to please him. The result of the battle had been regrettable. Napoleon dropped ironic remarks during Favier's account, as if to let it be understood that he had not expected it to be otherwise in his absence. "I must make up for that in Moscow," he said. "I shall see you again later," he added, and summoned de Bussy, who by that time had succeeded in preparing his surprise, having placed something on the two chairs and thrown a cover over it. De Bussy made one of those low, courtly bows that only old Bourbon retainers knew how to make, and stepping forward presented in an envelope. Napoleon turned to him and jovially pinched his ear. "You've been quick. Glad to see you. Well, what is Paris saying?" he asked, suddenly changing his former stern expression for one of extreme cordiality. "Sire, all Paris regrets your absence," replied de Bussy, as was proper. But though Napoleon knew that de Bussy had to say this, or something of the sort, and though in his lucid moments he knew it was untrue, he was pleased to hear him say it. He honored him with another little flick on the ear. "I am sorry to have given you such a long journey," he said. "Sire, I expected nothing less than to find you at the gates of Moscow," said de Bussy. Napoleon smiled and absent-mindedly raised his head and glanced to the right. An aide-de-camp glided forward with a gold snuff-box, which he offered to him. Napoleon took it. "Yes, it has turned out luckily for you," he said, putting the open snuff-box to his nose. "You are fond of travel, and in 3 days you will see Moscow. You probably didn't expect to see the Asiatic capital. It will be a pleasant excursion for you." De Bussy bowed in gratitude for this attention to his bent for travel, which he had never been aware of till then. "Ah, what have we here?" asked Napoleon, noticing that all his courtiers were gazing at something concealed under a covering. With courtly dexterity and not turning his back to the emperor, de Bussy retired two steps, made a half-turn, and whipped off the covering as he announced, "A present for your majesty from the empress." It was a portrait, painted in brilliant colors by Girard, of the son born to Napoleon and the daughter of the emperor of Austria, the child whom, for some reason, everyone called the King of Rome. A very beautiful, curly-headed little boy with eyes like those of the infant Christ, in the painting of the Sistine Madonna, was depicted playing cup and ball. The ball represented the terrestrial globe, and the cup held in his other hand was in the form of a scepter. Though it was not altogether clear what the artist had intended to express by portraying the so-called King of Rome transfixing the earth on a staff, the allegory evidently seemed to Napoleon, as it had seemed to everyone who had seen it in Paris, quite clear and exceedingly pleasing. "The King of Rome," he exclaimed, pointing to the picture with a graceful gesture, "admirable." With the natural faculty of the Italian for altering the expression of his face at will, he approached the portrait and assumed a look of pensive tenderness. He felt that what he said and did at that moment would be historic, and it occurred to him that the best thing he could do now, he, whose greatness was such that his child could play cup and ball with the terrestrial globe, would be to display, in contrast with that grandeur, the simplest paternal tenderness. His eyes dimmed with emotion. He moved forward, looked about for a chair. One seemed to place itself under him, and sat down before the portrait. At a single gesture from him, everyone withdrew on tiptoe, leaving the great man alone with his feelings. Having sat there for a while, he touched the rough highlights of the canvas, without himself knowing why, then rose and recalled de Bussy and the officer on duty. He gave orders for the portrait to be carried out and placed in front of his tent, so that the old guard stationed there might not be deprived of the pleasure of seeing the King of Rome, son and heir of their beloved monarch. Just as he expected, while sitting at breakfast with Monsieur de Bussy, whom he had honored with an invitation to join him, he heard the rapturous cries of the officers and soldiers of the old guard who had run up in haste to see the portrait. "Long live the Emperor! Long live the King of Rome! Long live the Emperor!" the cries of enthusiasm rang out. After breakfast, in Dubusset's presence, Napoleon dictated his order of the day to the army. "Brief and forceful," he remarked, after reading over the proclamation he had dictated straight off without corrections. It read, "Soldiers, this is the battle you have longed for. Victory depends on you. It is essential for us. It will give us all we need, comfortable quarters and a speedy return to our country. Acquit yourselves as you did at Austerlitz, Friedland, Vitebsk, and Smolensk. Let future generations recall your achievements of this day with pride. May it be said of you, he was in the great battle at the gates of Moscow." "Moscow," repeated Napoleon, and inviting Monsieur de Bussy, who was so fond of travel, to accompany him on his ride, he went out of the tent to where the saddled horses stood. "Your Majesty is too kind," said de Bussy, in response to the invitation to accompany the Emperor. He wanted to sleep, did not ride well, and was afraid of horses. But Napoleon nodded to the traveler, and de Bussy was obliged to mount. When Napoleon came out of the tent, the shouting of the guards before his son's portrait grew still louder. "Take him away," he said, indicating the portrait with a regally graceful gesture. "It is too soon for him to look on a battlefield." De Bussy, with a deep sigh, closed his eyes and bowed his head to signify his respect and understanding for the Emperor's words. Chapter 27. On the 25th of August, so his historians tell us, Napoleon spent the whole day on horseback, inspecting the terrain, considering plans submitted to him by his marshals, and personally giving commands to his generals. The original line of the Russian disposition along the Kolcha had been dislocated by the capture of the Shevardino Redoubt on the 24th, and part of the line, the left flank, had been drawn back. That part of the line was not fortified, was no longer protected by the river, and in front of it the ground was more open and level than elsewhere. It was obvious to anyone, soldier or civilian, that it was here that the French should attack. It would appear that no great deliberations nor any particular effort or trouble on the part of the Emperor and his marshals would be required to arrive at this conclusion. And there was certainly no need of that singular and exalted faculty known as genius, which people are so prone to ascribe to Napoleon. Yet historians who subsequently described the event, the men who surrounded Napoleon at the time, and he himself, thought otherwise. Napoleon rode over the plain, surveying the terrain with a look of profound thoughtfulness, dubiously shaking his head or nodding it in approval, and without communicating to the generals accompanying him the deep course of reasoning that led him to his decisions, he simply conveyed to them his final conclusions in the form of commands. After listening to a suggestion from Davout, now called Prince of Ekmir, to turn the Russian left flank, Napoleon said it should not be done, without explaining why this would not be necessary. But to a proposal made by General Campan, who was to attack the Fleches, to lead his division through the woods, Napoleon agreed, though the Duke of Elchingen, that is, Ney, ventured to observe that a movement through the woods was hazardous and might break up the formation. Having inspected the terrain opposite the Shevardino Redoubt, Napoleon pondered a while in silence and then indicated the points where two batteries were to be set up for the next day's action against the Russian entrenchments, and the places where, in line with them, the field artillery should be placed. After giving these and other commands, he returned to his tent, and the battle disposition was written from his dictation. This disposition, of which French historians speak with rapture, and other historians with profound respect, was as follows. At dawn, the two new batteries set up during the night on the plain occupied by the Prince of Eckmühl will open fire on the two enemy batteries opposite. At the same time, the artillery commander of the 1st Corps, General Pernetti, with 30 cannon of Compans' division and all the howitzers of Dessau's and Friant's divisions, will advance, open fire, and bombard the enemy's batteries against which will operate. 24 guns of the Guards' artillery, 30 guns of Compans' division, and 8 guns of Friant's and Dessau's divisions. 62 guns in all. The commander of the artillery of the 3rd Corps, General Fouché, will place the howitzers of the 3rd and 8th Corps, 16 in all, on the flanks of the battery that is to bombard the left fortification, which will have 40 guns in all directed against it. General Sorbier is to be ready at the first command to strike with all the howitzers of the Guards' artillery against either of the entrenchments. During the cannonade, Prince Poniatowski will advance to the village through the wood and turn the enemy's position. General Compans will move through the wood to take the first entrenchment. The action thus begun, subsequent orders will be issued in accordance with the enemy's movements. The cannonade on the left flank will begin as soon as the guns of the right wing are heard. The sharpshooters of Morand's division and the Viceroy's division will open heavy fire on seeing the attack on the right wing begin. The Viceroy will take the village, Borodino, cross by its three bridges, advancing to the same height as Morand's and Gerard's divisions, which, under his leadership, will be directed against the redoubt and come into line with the rest of the forces. All this must be done in good order, as far as possible, keeping troops in reserves. Dated the Imperial Camp near Mozhaisk, 6th September 1812. This disposition, which is exceedingly obscure and confused, if one permits oneself to examine it without a reverent awe of Napoleon's genius, contains 4 points, 4 orders, not one of which was or could have been carried out. In the disposition, it is stated first that the batteries set up on the locations selected by Napoleon, with the guns of Pernetti and Fouché, which were to come in line with them, 102 in all, were to open fire and bombard the Russian flèches and redoubts. This could not be done, as from the spots designated by Napoleon, the projectiles did not carry to the Russian works, and those 102 guns were fired to no purpose until, contrary to Napoleon's orders, the nearest commander moved them up. The second order was that Poniatowski advance to the village through the wood and turn the Russian left flank. This could not be done, and was not done, because Poniatowski, advancing on the village through the wood, met Chukov there, blocking his way, and could not and did not turn the Russian position. The third order was General Compans will move through the wood to take the first entrenchment. General Compans' division did not take the first entrenchment, was repulsed, for, on emerging from the wood, it had to reform on the grapeshot fire, which Napoleon did not know. The fourth, the Viceroy, will take the village of Borodino, cross by its three bridges, advancing to the same height as Morand's and Gerard's divisions, for whose movements no directions are given, which, under his leadership, will be directed against the redoubt and come into line with the rest of the forces. As far as one can make out, not so much from this unintelligible sentence as from the Viceroy's attempts to execute the orders given him, he was to advance from the left through Borodino to the redoubt, while Morand's and Gerard's divisions were simultaneously to advance from the front. All this, like the other points of the disposition, was not and could not have been carried out. After going through Borodino, the Viceroy was driven back to the Kolchak and could advance no farther, while Morand's and Gerard's divisions did not take the redoubt but were repulsed, and the redoubt was captured only at the end of the battle by the cavalry, in an action probably unforeseen and not heard of by Napoleon. so not one of the orders of the disposition was or could have been executed. But in a disposition, it is said that the action thus begun, subsequent orders will be issued in accordance with the enemy's movements. And it might therefore be supposed that all necessary dispositions would be issued by Napoleon during the battle. But this was not and could not have been done, for during the whole engagement, he was so far away that, as appeared later, he could not know the course of the battle, and not one of his orders during the conflict could be executed.
This is Eric Barnow of Columbia University, author of The Image Empire. I'm going to read chapter 28. Many historians say that the French failed to win the Battle of Borodino because Napoleon had a cold, and that if he had not had a cold, the orders he gave before and during the battle would have evinced even greater genius, and Russia would have been destroyed and the face of the world would have been changed. Two historians who believe that Russia was shaped by the will of one man, Peter the Great, and that France was transformed from a republic into an empire, and French armies marched into Russia at the will of one man, Napoleon. The argument that Russia remained a power because Napoleon had a bad cold on the 24th may seem logical and convincing. If it had depended on Napoleon's will whether or not to give battle at Borodino, and if it had depended on his will whether or not to issue this or that order, then it is obvious that a cold, which influenced the manifestation of his will, might have determined Russia's salvation, and consequently the valet who forgot to bring Napoleon his waterproof boots on the 24th would have been Russia's savior. According to this course of reasoning, such a deduction is indisputable, as indisputable as the deduction Voltaire made in jest without knowing what he was jesting at when he said that the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day was due to Charles IX's upset stomach. But to men who do not believe that Russia was formed by the will of one man, Peter the Great, or that the French Empire was created in the war with Russia begun by one man, Napoleon, this argument seems not merely false and irrational, but contrary to all human nature. To the question, what causes historic events, another answer presents itself, namely, that the course of world events is predetermined from on high and depends on the coincidence of the wills of all who participate in those events, and that the influence of a Napoleon on the course of such events is purely superficial and imaginary. Strange as the hypothesis may seem at first glance that the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day did not proceed from Charles IX's will, and that it only seemed to him that the order he gave was the cause of it, or that the slaughter of 80,000 men at Borodino did not proceed from Napoleon's will, despite the fact that he gave orders for the commencement and conduct of the battle, but that it only seemed to him that he had caused it. Strange as these suppositions may appear, yet human dignity, which tells me that each of us is, if not more, at least not less, a man than the great Napoleon, demands the acceptance of that solution of the question, and historical research abundantly confirms it. At the Battle of Borodino, Napoleon did not fire a shot and did not kill anyone. All that was done by the soldiers, therefore it was not he who did the killing. The soldiers of the French army went to kill the Russian soldiers at Borodino not because of Napoleon's orders, but by their own volition. At the sight of an army barring their road to Moscow, the whole army, the French, Italians, Germans, Poles, hungry, ragged, and exhausted by the campaign, felt that the wine was drawn and must be drunk. Had Napoleon then forbidden them to fight the Russians, they would have killed him and would have proceeded to fight the Russians because it was inevitable. When they heard Napoleon's proclamation offering them, as consolation for mutilation and death, the tribute posterity would accord them for having been in the Battle of Moscow, they cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" just as they had cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" at the sight of the portrait of the boy transfixing the terrestrial globe on his toy staff, and just as they would have cried, "Vive l'Empereur!" to any absurdity that might have been told them. There was nothing left for them to do but shout, "Vive l'Empereur!" and go out and fight in order to get food and rest as conquerors in Moscow. So it was not because of Napoleon's commands that they killed their fellow men. And it was not Napoleon who directed the course of the battle, for none of his orders was executed, and during the battle he did not know what was going on before him. So the way in which those men slaughtered one another was not determined by Napoleon's will, but occurred independently of him, in accord with the wills of hundreds of thousands of men who took part in the common action. It only seemed to Napoleon that it all took place by his will. And so the question whether he had or had not a cold is of no more historic interest than the cold of the least of the transport soldiers. Napoleon's cold on the 26th becomes of still less importance in that the assertions are completely wrong that various writers have made that this cold was the cause of the disposition and orders during battle being inferior to those on former occasions. The disposition cited above is by no means inferior, is indeed superior to former dispositions which had won him victories. His supposed orders during the battle were also no worse than those given on previous occasions, but were typical. They only seemed worse because the Battle of Borodino was the first battle Napoleon failed to win. The very best and most deeply considered dispositions and orders seem inferior and are pompously criticized by every military expert when they have not resulted in victory, and the very worst of dispositions and orders seem excellent, and serious men devote whole volumes to demonstrating their merits when a battle has been won by them. The disposition drawn up by Weyrother for the Battle of Austerlitz was a model of perfection of its kind, yet it was criticized for its very perfection, for its excessive detail. At the Battle of Borodino, Napoleon played his part as the representative of authority as well as, or even better than, at any other engagement. He did nothing to hinder the progress of the battle. He inclined to the most reasonable opinions, created no confusion, did not contradict himself, lose his head, or flee the battlefield, but, with his sound judgment and great military experience, calmly and competently performed his role of appearing to be in command. Now, chapter 29. On returning from a second thorough inspection of the lines, Napoleon said, "The chessmen are up. Tomorrow the game begins." He ordered some punch, sent for de Beausset, and began talking to him about Paris and about certain changes he intended to make in the Empress's household, surprising the prefect by his capacity for remembering the minutest detail relating to the court. He showed an interest in trifles and jested about de Beausset's love of travel, chatting as casually as a celebrated, self-assured, and practiced surgeon will sometimes chat while rolling up his sleeves and putting on his apron as the patient is being strapped to the operating table. "I have everything under control. It's all precise and clear in my head. When the time comes to set to work, I shall perform as no one else could do, but at the moment I can jest, and the more I jest and the calmer I am, the more serene and confident you ought to be and the more amazed at my genius." Having finished his second glass of punch, Napoleon went to rest before the serious business which, as he thought, awaited him the next day. He was so preoccupied with what lay before him that he was unable to sleep, and despite his cold, which had grown worse with the evening dampness, at 3 o'clock in the morning he got up and went into the large compartment of the tent, loudly blowing his nose. He asked whether the Russians had not withdrawn. When he was told that the enemy's campfires were still in the same places, he nodded his head in satisfaction. The adjutant on duty came into the tent. "Well, Rapp, do you think we shall succeed today?" Napoleon asked him. "Oh, without any doubt, sire," replied Rapp. Napoleon looked at him. "Do you remember, sire, the remark you were pleased to make to me at Smolensk?" asked Rapp. "The wine is drawn and must be drunk." Napoleon frowned and sat for some time in silence, his head resting on his hand. "This poor army," he said suddenly, "has greatly diminished since Smolensk. Fortune is an arrant whore, Rapp. I've always said it. Now I'm beginning to experience it." "But the guards, Rapp, the guards are intact?" he inquired, searchingly. "Yes, sire," answered Rapp. Napoleon took a pastille, put it in his mouth, and looked at his watch. He was not sleepy. Morning was still a long way off, and there were no further orders he could give for the sake of killing time, for they had all been issued and were now being executed. "Have the rusks and rice been distributed to the regiments or the guards?" he asked sternly. "Yes, sire." "The rice, too?" Rapp replied that he had transmitted the emperor's orders concerning the rice, But Napoleon shook his head with a dissatisfied air, as though he doubted whether his intentions had been carried out. A servant came in with the punch. Napoleon ordered another glass for Rapp, and took a few sips from his own in silence. "I can neither taste nor smell," he said, sniffing at the glass. "I'm sick of this cold. They talk about medicine. What's the good of their medicine when they can't cure a cold? Corvisart gave me these pastilles, but they don't help at all. What can they cure? One can't cure anything. Our body is a machine for living. It's organized for it. That's its nature. Let life go on in it unhindered. Let it defend itself. It will do more by itself than it will if you paralyze it by glutting it with remedies. Our body is like a perfect watch, meant to go on for a certain time. The watchmaker can't open it. He can only fumble with it blindfold. Our body is a machine for living, that's all." And once he had launched into definitions for which he had a great liking, he unexpectedly formulated a new one. "Do you know, Rapp, what the military art consists of?" he asked. "It's the art of being stronger than the enemy at a given moment, that's all." Rapp made no reply. "Tomorrow we shall have Kutuzov to deal with," said Napoleon. "We shall see. Remember when he was in command at Braunau, he never once mounted a horse to inspect the fieldworks? We shall see." He glanced at his watch. It was 4 o'clock. He still felt no desire to sleep. The punch was finished. There was nothing to do. He got up, walked to and fro, then put on a hat and warm overcoat and went outside. The night was dark and damp. A scarcely perceptible drizzle was falling. Nearby, the campfires of the French guards burnt brightly, and in the distance, those of the Russian line glimmered through the smoke. All was still, and the rustle and tramp of French troops, already moving up to their positions, was clearly audible. Napoleon paced up and down in front of his tent, looking at the fires and listening to the shuffle of feet, and as he passed a tall guardsman in a shaggy cap, who was on sentry duty before his tent and had drawn himself up like a black pillar at the sight of the emperor, Napoleon stopped in front of him. "Well, what year did you enter the service?" he asked, with that affectation of bluff military geniality with which he always addressed the soldiers. The man answered him. "Ah, an old campaigner. Has your regiment had its rice?" "Yes, Your Majesty." Napoleon nodded and walked away. At 5:30, Napoleon rode to the village of Shevardino. It was growing light, the sky was clearing, a solitary cloud hung in the east. The deserted campfires were burning out in the pale morning light. A single muted cannon shot boomed on the right and died away in the prevailing silence. Several minutes passed. A second and a third report shook the air. Somewhere near on the right, a fourth and a fifth solemnly resounded. The first shots had not yet ceased to reverberate when others rang out, then more and more, mingling with and overtaking one another. Napoleon and his suite rode up to the Shevardino redoubt, where he dismounted. The game had begun. Now, Chapter 30. On returning to Gorky, after having seen Prince Andrei, Pierre ordered his groom to get the horses ready and to call him early in the morning. Then he immediately fell asleep behind a screen in a corner that Boris had let him have. By the time he was fully awake the next morning, everyone had left the hut. The panes were rattling in the little windows, and his groom was standing at his side shaking him. "Your Excellency! Your Excellency! Your Excellency!" the groom persistently repeated, shaking Pierre by the shoulder, without looking at him, as if having lost hope of rousing him. "What? Has it begun? Is it time?" Pierre mumbled sleepily. "If you'll please, sir, listen to the firing," said the groom, a discharged soldier. "The other gentlemen have already gone. His Serene Highness himself rode by not long ago." Pierre hastily dressed and ran out to the porch. Outside it was fresh and dewy, a bright clear day. The sun had just burst forth from behind a cloud that had obscured it, and its rays refracted through rifts in the clouds, splashed over the roofs and walls of the houses opposite, over the dew-flecked dust of the road, the fenced palings, and Pierre's horses standing in front of the hut. The boom of cannons sounded more distinct outside. An adjutant, accompanied by a Cossack, rode by at a trot. "It's time, Count, it's time," cried the adjutant. Telling his groom to follow with a horse, Pierre walked along the street to the knoll from which he had surveyed the battlefield the day before. A crowd of officers had assembled there, and Pierre heard the members of the staff talking in French, saw Kutuzov's gray head in a white cap with a red band, saw his gray nape sunk between his shoulders. He was peering through a field glass at the highway. Looking before him as he mounted the steps of the approach to the knoll, Pierre was spellbound by the beauty of the scene. It was the same panorama he had admired the day before, but now the entire region was covered with troops and clouds of smoke from the guns, and in the clear morning air the slanting rays of the bright sun, which was rising slightly to the left behind Pierre, suffused it with a rosy golden light streaked with long dark shadows. The distant forests that enclosed the panorama seemed carved out of some precious stone of a yellowish-green color. Its undulating contour, silhouetted against the horizon, was intersected beyond Valuyevo by the Smolensk Highway, now crowded with troops. In the foreground shimmered golden fields and thickets. Everywhere, in front and to the right and left, there were troops. The whole scene was vivid, majestic, and astounding. But what impressed Pierre most was the view of the battlefield itself, of Borodino, and the ravines on either side of the Kolocha. Over the river, over Borodino and on both sides of it, especially to the left, where the Vojno flowed through marshy land and fell into the Kolocha, hung a mist that spread, dissolved, and grew translucent in the brilliant sunlight, magically tinting and outlining everything seen through it. The smoke of the guns mingled with this mist, and everywhere glints of morning light sparkled through it, now on the water, now on the dew, now on the bayonets of the soldiers crowded along the river banks and in Borodino. A white church could be seen through the mist, here and there a cottage roof, dense masses of troops, green caissons, cannons, and all was in motion or appeared to move as the smoke and mist drifted over the whole landscape. Just as in the mist-covered hollows near Borodino, so along the entire line, beyond and above it, and especially to the left, in woods and meadows, over valleys and on ridges, clouds of cannon smoke seemed to materialize out of nothing, now singly, now several at a time, now sparse, now dense, expanding, bellowing, merging, swirling over the whole expanse. These puffs of smoke, and strange to say, the reports that accompanied them, produced the chief beauty of the spectacle. Poof! Suddenly a round, dense ball of smoke was seen turning from violet to gray to a milky white, and boom! Came the report a second later. Poof, poof! Two clouds of smoke rose, colliding and merging with one another. Boom, boom! Came the sounds confirming what the eye had seen. Pierre looked back at the first puff of smoke, which an instant before had been a round, compact ball, and in its place he saw balloons of smoke drifting away to one side, and poof, a pause, then three more, then four appeared. Each one answered at identical intervals by a firm, precise, majestic boom, boom, boom. At one moment the smoke cloud seemed to scud across the sky, at the next to remain fixed, while the woods and fields and glittering bayonets sped past them. From the left, over fields and bushes, these great balls of smoke were continually appearing, followed by their solemn reverberations, while nearer still, in the woods and hollows, burst little puffs of musket smoke that hardly formed into balls, but in the same way had their tiny reports. Thrack-tack came the rapid, uneven crack of musketry, which sounded feeble in comparison to the rhythmic roar of the cannons. Pierre wanted to be there in the midst of that smoke and sound and movement, where all those gleaming bayonets and cannons were. He looked around at Kutuzov and his suite to compare his impressions with those of others. They, too, were all looking at the battlefield, and, as it seemed to him, with the same feelings. Every face shone with that latent heat of emotion that Pierre had noticed the day before, and which he fully understood after his talk with Prince Andrei. Go, my dear fellow, go, and Christ be with you, Kutuzov was saying to the general standing beside him, his eyes still fixed on the battlefield. The general who received the order passed Pierre on his way down the knoll. To the crossing, replied the general in a cold, austere tone to the staff officer who asked where he was going. I, too. I'll go there, too, thought Pierre, and followed him. The general mounted the horse a Cossack led up to him. Pierre went to the groom who was holding his horses. After ascertaining which of them was the most docile, he mounted and, clutching the horse's mane, turned out his toes and pressed his heels into the horse's belly. He felt that his spectacles were slipping off, but was unable to let go of the mane or the reins, and galloped off after the general, eliciting smiles of amusement from the staff officers who were watching him.
This is Dale Miner. I'll be reading from Book 3, Part 2, Chapters 31 and 32, pages 950 to 959. When he reached the bottom of the hill, the general turned sharply to the left, and Pierre, losing sight of him, plunged into the ranks of an infantry battalion marching in front of him. He tried to extricate himself, turning to the right and to the left, but there were soldiers everywhere, all with the same preoccupied expression, intent upon some unseen but patently important task. They all directed the same questioning look of annoyance at this stout man in the white hat, who for some reason threatened to trample them under his horse's hoofs. "Why ride into the middle of a battalion?" one of them shouted at him. Another prodded his horse with the butt end of a musket, and Pierre, bending over his saddle bow and hardly able to hold in his horse, galloped ahead of the soldiers to where there was an open space. On a bridge ahead of him, there were soldiers firing. Pierre rode up to them. Though unaware of it, he had come to the bridge over the Kolochka between Gorky and Borodino, which the French, having taken Borodino, were attacking in the first action of the battle. Pierre saw the bridge, saw that there were soldiers doing something in the smoke on both sides of it, and in the meadow among the rows of new-mown hay that he had noticed the day before. But despite the incessant firing going on there, it never occurred to him that this was the actual field of battle. He did not hear the bullets whistling on all sides, or the projectiles flying overhead, nor did he see the enemy on the other side of the river, and for a long time failed to notice the dead and wounded, though many fell near him. He looked about him with a smile that never left his face. "What's he doing in front of the line?" someone shouted. "To the left. Go to the right," the men shouted at him. Pierre went to the right and, unexpectedly, encountered one of General Rayevsky's adjutants. The adjutant glanced furiously at him, and he, too, was about to shout, then recognized him and nodded. "How did you get here?" he said, and galloped on. Feeling out of place and useless, and afraid of getting in someone's way again, Pierre galloped after the adjutant. "What's happening here? May I come with you?" he asked. Just a moment," replied the adjutant, and riding up to a stout colonel who was standing in the meadow, gave him a message, then turned to Pierre. "What brings you here, Count?" he asked with a smile, still curious. "Yes, yes," replied Pierre. But the adjutant wheeled about and started to ride on. "It's not so bad here," he said, "but on the left flank, with Bagration, they're getting it hot." "Really?" said Pierre. "Where is that?" "Come along with me to our knoll. We can get a view from there. It's still not too bad at our battery," said the adjutant. "Will you come?" "Yes, I'll come with you," said Pierre, looking around, trying to see his groom. It was only now, for the first time, that Pierre noticed the wounded men, frantically staggering along or being carried on stretchers. On the very meadow he had ridden over the day before, a soldier lay athwart the rows of sweet-scented hay, his head awkwardly thrown back, his shako off. "Why haven't they picked him up?" Pierre was about to ask, but seeing the adjutant's stern face turned in the same direction, he checked himself. Pierre did not find his groom, and rode along the hollow with the adjutant toward Rayevsky's redoubt. The horse trailed behind the adjutant and jolted him at every step. You don't seem to be accustomed to riding, Count, remarked the adjutant. No, it's not that, but her action is somewhat jerky, said Pierre in a puzzled tone. Why, she's wounded, exclaimed the adjutant. The off foreleg above the knee. A bullet, no doubt. I congratulate you, Count, on your baptism of fire. Having ridden through the smoke past the Sixth Corps, behind the artillery, which had been moved forward and was keeping up a deafening cannonade, they came to a small wood. There it was cool and quiet, with a scent of autumn. Is the general here? Asked the adjutant on reaching the redoubt. He was here a minute ago, but he went that way, someone answered, pointing to the right. The adjutant looked at Pierre as if not knowing what to do with him. Don't bother about me, said Pierre. I'll go up on the knoll if I may. Yes, do. You'll see everything from there, and it's less dangerous. I'll come for you. Pierre went to the battery, and the adjutant rode on. They did not meet again, and only much later did Pierre learn that the adjutant had lost an arm that day. The knoll to which Pierre ascended was that famous one, afterwards known to the Russians as the Knoll Battery, or Raevsky's Redoubt, around which tens of thousands fell, and which the French regarded as the key position. This redoubt consisted of a knoll, on three sides of which trenches were dug. Within the entrenchment stood 10 guns that were firing through the embrasures of the breastworks. In line with the knoll, on both sides, were other cannons that were also firing. A little behind the guns stood infantry. When he ascended this knoll, Pierre had no notion that this spot, on which some not very large trenches had been dug and from which a few guns were firing, was the most important point of the battle. On the contrary, he thought it one of the least significant places simply because he happened to be there. When he reached the knoll, Pierre sat down at the end of the trench that enclosed the battery and gazed at what was going on around him with an unconsciously happy smile. From time to time he stood up and walked about the battery, still with the same smile, trying not to get in the way of the soldiers who were continually running past him with powder pouches and charges, loading and returning the guns to battery position. The guns of that battery were being fired one after another without interruption, creating a deafening roar and enveloping the whole vicinity in smoke. In contrast to the dread felt by the infantrymen of the covering force, here in the battery, where there was a small number of men separated from the rest by a trench and busy with their jobs, there was a general feeling of excitement, a family feeling, as it were, shared by all. The apparition of Pierre's unmilitary figure and white hat made an unfavorable impression at first. The soldiers cast sidelong glances of surprise and even alarm as they passed him. The senior artillery officer, a tall, long-legged man with a pockmarked face, on the pretense of inspecting the action of the end gun, walked over to Pierre and looked at him with curiosity. A young, round-faced little officer, still a mere boy and apparently just out of the cadet corps, who was diligently commanding the 2 guns entrusted to him, addressed Pierre sternly. "Sir, permit me to ask you to stand aside," he said. "You cannot remain here." The soldiers shook their heads disapprovingly as they looked at Pierre. But when they were convinced that this man in the white hat was not only doing no harm, as he sat quietly on the slope of the trench or with a shy, courteous smile made way for the soldiers, but that he walked about the battery under fire as calmly as if he were strolling on a boulevard, their feeling of hostile perplexity gradually changed to a friendly, playful sodality, such as soldiers have with the dogs, cocks, goats, and other animals that share the fortunes of the regiment. And before long, Pierre was tacitly accepted as one of the family. They adopted him, nicknamed him Our Gentleman, and made good-natured fun of him among themselves. A shell tore up the earth a couple of paces from Pierre. Brushing off the earth that had been scattered over his clothes, he looked about him with a smile. "How is it you're not afraid, sir, really now?" a red-faced, broad-shouldered soldier asked Pierre, with a grin that disclosed a sound set of white teeth. "Are you afraid, then?" asked Pierre. "Of course. What do you expect?" replied the soldier. "That one's merciless, you know. She smashes into you, your guts fly out." "You can't help being afraid," he said, laughing. Several of the men stopped beside Pierre with amused, friendly faces. For some reason, they had not expected him to talk like anybody else, and seemed delighted to discover that he did. It's our job. We're soldiers. But for a gentleman, it's amazing. Now there's a real gentleman for you.
You're listening to a reading of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace over listener-sponsored WBAI New York.
Resume stations, shouted the young officer to the men scattered around Pierre. It was evidently the first or second time this young officer had been on duty, and consequently he was scrupulously correct and formal in his behavior both to the soldiers and his superior officer. The booming cannonade and the rattle of musketry was intensifying over the whole field, especially to the left of Bagration's Fleche. But from where Pierre stood, hardly anything could be seen for the smoke. In any case, his whole attention was absorbed in watching the little family circle of men shut off from all the rest. His first unconscious delight in the sights and sounds of the battlefield had given place to another feeling, especially since he had seen that solitary figure lying on the meadow. Now, seated on the slope of the trench, he observed the faces of those around him. By 10 o'clock, some 20 men had been borne away. Two guns were disabled. Shells were falling more and more frequently on the battery, and bullets hummed and whistled through the air. But the men of the battery appeared not to notice all this, and their cheerful voices and their quips rang out on all sides. "Little pineapple," cried a soldier as a grenade came whistling through the air toward them. "Not here, over to the infantry," added another, with a boisterous laugh, seeing the missile fly past and fall into the ranks of the covering forces. "Friend of yours," remarked a third soldier, laughing at a peasant who ducked as a cannonball flew over. Several soldiers gathered at the bulwark, trying to make out what had happened in front. "They've withdrawn the front line. Look, they've moved back," they were saying, pointing over the bulwark. "Mind your own business," an old sergeant shouted at them. "If they've moved back, it's because the action is there." And taking one of the men by the shoulder, he gave him a shove with his knee. There was a burst of laughter. "Fifth gun in battery position," rang out the command from one side. "Now then, all together, like bargemen," rose the merry voices of the men wheeling up the cannon. "Aye, that one nearly picked off our gentleman's hat," cried the red-faced wag, grinning at Pierre. "Ah, you're a bungler," he added reproachfully to a shell that struck a cannon wheel and tore off a man's leg. "Now then, you foxes," another said with a laugh to some militiamen who, stooping low, entered the battery to carry away the wounded man. "Don't care much for our diet, do you? Oh, you crows." "That gave them a turn," they shouted at the militiamen, hesitating before the soldier whose leg had been torn off. "Come on, fellows," they taunted the peasants. "They can't take it." Pierre noticed that after every cannonball that hit the redoubt, and after every man that fell, the general exhilaration was heightened. Lightning flashes of a hidden blazing fire, like those of an approaching thundercloud, flamed in the faces of the men, as if to counteract what was happening, with increasing brightness and frequency. Pierre did not look out at the battlefield, and was not concerned to know what was going on there. He was wholly absorbed in contemplating this fire that burned ever more brightly, and which he felt was burning in his own soul, too. At 10 o'clock, the infantry that had been in the thicket and along the Kaminka River retreated. They could be seen running back past the battery, bearing their wounded on their muskets. A general with his suite came up onto the knoll, spoke to the colonel, looked angrily at Pierre, and having ordered the infantry covering forces behind the battery to lie down so as to be less exposed to fire, went away again. After this, from amid the ranks of the infantry to the right of the battery, came the sound of a drum and shouts of command, and from the battery they could see the infantry ranks move forward. Looking over the earthworks, Pierre was particularly struck by one pale young officer who, letting his sword hang down and glancing uneasily about him, was walking backward. The infantry disappeared in the smoke, but their prolonged cheers and rapid musket fire could still be heard. A few minutes later, crowds of wounded men and stretcher bearers came from that direction. Shells were beginning to fall on the battery with greater and greater frequency. Several men had been left lying there. The soldiers around the cannons moved with still more alacrity and dispatch. They no longer paid any attention to Pierre. Once or twice he was furiously shouted at for being in the way. The colonel quickly strode from one gun to another, a scowl on his face. The young officer, his cheeks deeply flushed, was increasingly punctilious in giving his commands. The soldiers serving the guns turned, loaded, and bounded about as if on strings, performing their tasks with strained alertness. The thundercloud had come upon them, and the fire that Pierre had seen kindling now flamed in every face. He was standing beside the colonel when the young officer, his hand to his shako, ran up to his superior officer. "I have the honor to report, sir, that there are only 8 rounds left. Are we to continue firing?" he asked. "Grape shot," cried the senior officer, who was looking over the wall of the trench and ignored the question. All at once something happened. The young officer gasped, bent double, and sank to the ground like a bird shot on the wing. Everything blurred before Pierre's eyes, seemed murky and uncanny. Cannonball after cannonball whistled past, striking the earthworks, a soldier, a gun. Pierre, who had scarcely heard these sounds before, now heard nothing else. On the right of the battery, soldiers shouting, "Hurrah!" were running, not forward, it seemed to Pierre, but back. "All with grape shot," shouted the officer. The sergeant ran up to him, and in a terrified whisper, like a butler informing the host at the dinner party that there is no more of the wine he asked for, said that they were out of charges. "Cutthroats, what are they doing?" cried the officer, turning toward Pierre. The officer's face was flushed and perspiring, and his eyes glittered under his lowering brow. "Run to the reserves. Bring up the ammunition chests," he yelled, his furious glance passing over Pierre to one of his men. "I'll go," said Pierre. The colonel, without answering, strode across to the other side. "Cease fire! Wait!" he roared. The soldier, who had been ordered to go for ammunition, collided with Pierre. "Ah, sir, this is no place for you," he said, and ran down the slope. Pierre ran after him, avoiding the place where the young officer had slumped to the ground and was left in a sitting position. One cannonball, a second, a third flew over him, falling in front, behind, and beside him. Pierre continued to run down the slope. "Where am I going?" he suddenly asked himself as he neared the green powder wagons. He stopped, uncertain whether to return or go on. All at once a violent concussion flung him backward to the ground. At the same instant, there was a blinding flash and a deafening, resounding whistle and detonation. When he came to himself, he was sitting on the ground, leaning on his hands. The powder wagon that had been beside him was gone. Only a few charred green boards and some rags littered the scorched grass, and a horse dragging fragments of its shafts after it galloped by, while another horse lay like Pierre on the ground and uttered prolonged, piercing shrieks. Beside himself with terror, Pierre jumped up and ran back to the battery as to the only refuge from the horrors surrounding him. On entering the trench, he noticed that there was no sound of firing from the battery, but there were men doing something there. He had no time to grasp who these men were. He caught sight of the colonel lying across the breastwork, his back to him, as though examining something below, and saw a soldier he had noticed earlier who kept shouting, "Brothers," as he struggled to free himself from some men who were holding him by the arms. And he saw something else that was strange. But he had not had time to realize that the colonel had been killed, that the man shouting "Brothers" was taken prisoner, and that another man had been bayoneted in the back right before his eyes. For hardly had he come running into the redoubt when a thin, sallow-faced, perspiring man in blue uniform rushed at him, sword in hand and shouting. Instinctively, guarding himself against the shock, as they were running full tilt against each other, he put out his hands and clutched the man, a French officer, by the shoulder and the throat. The officer dropped his sword and seized Pierre by the collar. For several seconds they gazed in consternation at one another's unfamiliar faces, both confounded by what they had done, and wondering what to do next. "Am I taken prisoner, or have I taken him prisoner?" each was thinking. But the French officer was evidently more inclined to think he had been captured, for Pierre's hand, in an instinctive reaction to terror, was tightening its grip on his throat. The Frenchman was attempting to say something when just over their heads a cannonball whistled terrifyingly low, and it seemed to Pierre that the Frenchman's head had been torn off, so swiftly had he ducked. Pierre, too, bent his head and let his hands fall. Without further thought as to who had taken whom prisoner, the Frenchman ran back to the battery, and Pierre ran down the slope, stumbling over the dead and wounded, who, it seemed to him, were catching at his feet. But before he reached the foot of the knoll, he was met by a dense crowd of Russian soldiers, stumbling, foundering, shouting in wild elation as they ran into the battery. This was the attack for which Ermolov claimed the credit, declaring it was only his bravery and good fortune that made such a feat possible, the attack in which he incited his men by flinging onto the redoubt a handful of St. George crosses which he had had in his pocket. The French who had taken the battery fled. Our troops, shouting hurrah, pursued them so far beyond the battery that it was difficult to stop them. The prisoners were brought down from the battery, among them a wounded French general whom the officers surrounded. Crowds of wounded, both French and Russian, several of whom Pierre recognized, their faces distorted by suffering, walked, crawled, or were carried on stretchers from the battery. Pierre went up on the knoll, where he had spent over an hour, and of that little family circle that had accepted him as one of themselves, not one was left. There were many among the dead whom he did not know, but some he recognized. At the end of the trench, the young officer, still slumped over, sat in a pool of blood. The red-faced soldier was still twitching, but they did not carry him away. Pierre ran down the slope. Surely they must now stop. Now they will be horrified at what they have done, he thought, aimlessly following the crowd of stretcher-bearers that was leaving the battery. But behind the veil of smoke, the sun was still high, and in front, especially on the left around Smolensk, there was a seething turmoil in the smoke. The roar of cannons and musketry, far from abating, had increased furiously, like a man exerting himself to the utmost to put forth one final desperate cry. This is Dale Miner. I've been reading from Book 3, Part 2, Chapters 31 and 32, pages 950 to 959.
I am Conrad Lynn. I am reading from Book 3, Chapters 33 and 34, pages 959 to 966. The chief action of the Battle of Borodino was fought within the 7,000 feet between Borodino and the Bagration Flesh. Outside of this area, the Russians had made a feint on one side with Uvarov's cavalry at midday, and on the other side, beyond Utitsa, there had been the skirmish between Tuchkov and Poniatowski. But these were two detached and relatively feeble engagements in comparison with what took place in the center of the battlefield. It was on the plain between Borodino and the Flesh, beside the wood, on an open expanse visible to both sides, that the chief action of the day was fought in the simplest and most artless way. The battle began on both sides with a cannonade of several hundred guns. Then, when the whole field was shrouded in smoke, two divisions, Compans and Demays, advanced on the Flesh from the right, looking from the French side, and the Vicoroy's regiment advanced on Borodino from the left. The Flesh were a verst from the Shevardino redoubt, where Napoleon was standing, and Borodino was more than two versts as the crow flies. Consequently, Napoleon could not see what was happening there, especially as the smoke, mingling with the mist, hid that entire area. The soldiers of Desaix's division, advancing on the Flesh, were visible only until they began to go down into the ravine that separated them from the outworks. As soon as they descended into the ravine, the smoke of the guns and musketry on the Flesh grew so dense that it obscured the entire slope on the farther side. Through the smoke it was possible to catch an occasional glimpse of something black, probably men or the glint of bayonets. But whether they were moving or stationary, whether French or Russian, could not be determined from the Shevardino redoubt. The rising sun was bright, and its slanting rays shone straight into Napoleon's face as, shading his eyes with his hand, he peered at the flesh. The smoke hung over them, and at times it looked as if the smoke were moving, at times as if it were the troops that moved. Now and then a shout was heard through the firing, but it was impossible to know what was going on there. Standing on the knoll, Napoleon looked through a field glass, and in the tiny circle of glass could discern smoke and men, sometimes his own, sometimes the Russians. But when he looked again with the naked eye, he was unable to tell where he had seen them. He descended the knoll and began to pace up and down in front of it. From time to time he stopped, listened to the firing, and contemplated the battlefield. Not only was it impossible to make out what was happening down below from where he stood, or from the knoll above on which some of his generals had taken their stand, but even from the flesh themselves, now occupied either simultaneously or alternately by Russian and French troops, dead, wounded, alive, panic-stricken, or maddened, it was impossible to understand what was taking place. For a period of several hours, amid incessant cannon and musket fire, there were now Russians alone, now French alone, now cavalry, now infantry. They appeared, fired, fell, met face to face, not knowing what to do with one another, raised a clamor, and ran back again. From the battlefield adjutants, he had sent out an orderly, and orderly officers from his marshals were continually galloping up to Napoleon with reports of the progress of the conflict. But all these reports were false, both because it is impossible in the heat of battle to say what is happening at any given moment, and because many of the adjutants did not go to the actual area of combat, but repeated what they had heard from others. Moreover, while an adjutant was riding two or three versts to reach Napoleon, circumstances changed, and the news he brought was no longer true. For instance, an adjutant came galloping up with word that Borodino had been taken, and the bridge over the Kolocha was now in the hands of the French. He asked whether Napoleon wanted the troops to cross it. Napoleon gave orders that they should draw up in battle formation on the farther side and wait. But before this command could be given, in fact, almost before the adjutant had left Borodino, the bridge had been retaken and burned by the Russians in the very skirmish at which Pierre had been present at the beginning of the battle. Another adjutant galloped from the flesh, his face pale and distraught, and reported to Napoleon that their attack had been repulsed, that Compans was wounded and Davout killed. Yet even at the time the adjutant was told that the attack had been repulsed, the flesh had been recaptured by another French unit, and Davout was alive and only slightly wounded. On the basis of such erroneous reports, Napoleon gave his orders, which had either been executed before he gave them, or else could not be and never were fulfilled. The marshals and generals who were nearer to the battlefield, but like Napoleon, not taking part in the actual fighting, and only occasionally going within bullet range, made their own dispositions without consulting Napoleon, and gave their own orders concerning the firing position and targets when the cavalry was to charge and when the infantry was to march double time. But even their orders, like Napoleon's, were seldom carried out, and then only partially. For the most part, what happened was altogether different from what was ordered. Soldiers ordered to advance on running into grape shop fell back. Soldiers ordered to stand their ground, suddenly seeing Russians appear where they had not expected them, sometimes ran back, sometimes ran forward, and the cavalry, without any orders, dashed off in pursuit of fleeing Russians. In this way, two cavalry regiments galloped through the Semyonovsk ravine, and as soon as they reached the crest of the hill, turned around and galloped full speed back again. The infantry likewise made off to points other than those to which they had been ordered. All orders concerning when and where to move up the guns when the infantry was to fire, when the cavalry was to run down Russian infantry. All such orders were issued by officers on the spot nearest to the units concerned without consulting Ney, Davout, or Marat, much less Napoleon. They had no fear of punishment for not carrying out orders or for acting on their own initiative. For what is at stake in battle is what is most precious to a man, his own life. And as it may sometimes seem that safety lies in running back, sometimes in running forward, these men who were right in the thick of battle acted on the impulse of the moment. In the main, all these movements, backward and forward, neither improved nor impaired the situation of the troops. All these sorties and assaults against one another did little harm. The harm, the death and mutilation, was the work of cannonballs and bullets, which were flying from every quarter over the field on which these men were laying about them. As soon as they got out of range of these missiles, their superior officers in the rear restored order and discipline, and under the influence of this discipline, led them back to the region under fire where, dominated by the fear of death, all discipline vanished, and they dashed about, submitting to the chance temper of the mob. Napoleon's generals, Ney, Davout, and Murat, who were near and sometimes even in that region under fire, more than once led into it huge masses of well-ordered troops. But contrary to what had invariably happened in all their former battles, instead of the anticipated reports of the enemy's rout, it was these disciplined hosts who returned in disorganized, panic-stricken crowds. The generals regrouped them, but their number was steadily dwindling. In the middle of the day, Murat sent his adjutant to Napoleon, demanding reinforcements. Napoleon was sitting at the foot of the knoll drinking punch when Murat's adjutant galloped up to assure him that the Russians would be routed if His Majesty would let them have another division. "Reinforcements," said Napoleon with grim astonishment, fixing his eyes on the adjutant, a handsome youth who wore his black curly hair shoulder length like Murat. "Reinforcements," thought Napoleon to himself. "How can they need reinforcements when they already have half the army directed against one weak, unentrenched Russian wing?" "Tell the King of Naples," he said sternly, that it is not yet noon, and I still do not see my chessboard clearly. Go." The handsome adjutant with the long hair heaved a deep sigh without taking his hand from his hat and galloped back to where men were being slaughtered. Napoleon got up and, summoning Caulaincourt and Berthier, began talking to them about matters not connected with the battle. In the middle of the conversation, which had begun to interest Napoleon, Berthier's eye was caught by a general with his suite who was galloping toward the knoll on a lathering horse. It was Belliard. Dismounting, he strode rapidly up to the emperor and in a loud voice boldly undertook to demonstrate the necessity for sending in reinforcements. He swore on his honor that the Russians would be lost if the emperor would let them have one more division. Napoleon twitched his shoulders and continued to pace up and down without answering. Belliard loudly and vehemently addressed the generals of the suite who were gathered around him. "You are very impetuous, Belliard," said Napoleon, turning back to him. "In the heat of battle, it is easy to make a mistake. Go and have another look, and then come back to me." Before Belliard was out of sight, a messenger from another part of the battlefield galloped up. "Well, what is it now?" asked Napoleon in the tone of a man exasperated by continual disturbances. "Sire, the prince," began the adjutant. "Wants reinforcements," said Napoleon with an irate gesture. The adjutant nodded his head affirmatively and proceeded to report, but the emperor turned away, took a couple of steps, stopped, came back, and called Berthier. "We'll have to give them reserves," he said with a gesture of resignation. "Who do you think should be sent?" he asked Berthier, whom he subsequently termed "that gosling I have made an eagle." "Send Clairaupeyd's division, sire," replied Berthier, who knew all the division's regiments and battalions by heart. Napoleon nodded assent. The adjutant galloped off to Clairaupeyd's division, and a few minutes later the young guards stationed behind the knoll were moving forward. Napoleon stood silently gazing in their direction. No, he suddenly said to Berthier, I cannot send Clara Ped. Send Friant's division. Although there was no advantage whatever in sending Friant's division instead of Clara Ped's, and even an obvious inconvenience and delay in recalling the one and sending the other, the order was executed with dispatch. Napoleon failed to see that in regard to his army, he played the part of the doctor who hinders by his remedies, a role he so rightly understood and condemned. Friant's division, like the others, disappeared into the smoke of the battlefield. Adjutants kept galloping up from every side, and all, as if having conspired together, said the same thing. They all asked for reinforcements. All said that the Russians were standing their ground and maintaining a hellish fire under which the French army was melting away. Napoleon sat on a camp stool, plunged in thought. Monsieur de Beausset, the man who was so fond of travel, having had nothing to eat since morning, approached the emperor and respectfully ventured to suggest lunch to his majesty. I trust I may at this time congratulate your majesty on a victory, he said. Napoleon shook his head. Assuming the negation to apply to the victory and not to lunch, Monsieur de Beausset took the liberty of observing with complacent facetiousness that there was no reason in the world for not having lunch when lunch was to be had. Go to, Napoleon muttered brusquely and turned his back on him. A beatific smile of rapture, repentance, and regret suffused de Beausset's face as he glided away to join the other generals. Napoleon was experiencing a feeling of depression, like that of a gambler who, after a long run of luck during which he has recklessly flung down his money and won every time, finds that suddenly, just when he has calculated all the chances of the game, the more he considers his play, the more surely he loses. His troops were the same, his generals the same. The same preparations had been made, the same dispositions, the same brief and forceful proclamation. He himself was the same. He knew this, knew that he was far more experienced and proficient than he had ever been before. And even the enemy was the same as at Austerlitz and Friedland. Yet the dread blow of his arm had fallen with mysterious impotence. All the old tactics that had uniformly crowned with success, the concentration of batteries on one point, the attack by reserves to breach the line, the cavalry charge by the men of iron, all had been employed. Not only was there no victory, but from all sides came the selfsame reports of generals killed and wounded, of reinforcements needed, of the impossibility of beating the Russians, and of the disorder of his own troops. Formerly, after he had given two or three orders and uttered a phrase or two, his marshals and adjutants had come rushing up with congratulations, announcing with joyous faces the trophies taken, a whole corps of prisoners, faggots of enemy standards, and eagles, cannons, and stores, and Murat positively implored permission to loose the cavalry to bring in the baggage wagons. So it had been at Lodi, Marengo, Arcola, Jena, Austerlitz, Wagram, and so on, and so on. But now something strange was happening to his armies. Despite the news of the capture of the flesh, Napoleon saw that it was not the same, not at all the same as it had been in former battles. He saw that what he was feeling was felt by all the men around him with combat experience. They all looked disheartened, and avoided one another's eyes. Only de Beausset failed to grasp the significance of what was happening. But Napoleon, with his vast experience of war, well knew what it meant when, after 8 hours and all the effort that had been expended, the battle had not been won by the attacking side. He knew that this was virtually a defeat, and that now, at this critical point of the battle, the least accident might destroy him and his army. When he went over in his mind the whole of this strange Russian campaign, in which not a single battle had been won, in which not a banner, nor a cannon, nor an army corps had been captured in 2 months, when he saw the covert dejection in the faces of the men around him, and heard reports of the Russians still standing their ground, a ghastly, nightmarish feeling came over him, and he thought of every adverse contingency that might conceivably destroy him. The Russians might assault his left wing, might breach his center. He himself might be killed by a stray cannonball. All this was possible. In former battles, he had considered only the chances of success. Now a multitude of possible disasters suggested themselves, and he anticipated them all. Yes, it was like a dream in which a man imagines a felon attacking him and raises his arm to deal his assailant a terrific blow that he knows must annihilate him, then feels his arm fall powerless, limp as a rag, and the horror of certain death overwhelms him in his helplessness. It was the report that the Russians were attacking the French army's left flank that aroused this dread in Napoleon. He sat in silence on a camp stool at the foot of the knoll, head down, his elbows on his knees. Berthier came up to him and suggested that they should ride along the line and ascertain the state of affairs. What did you say? Asked Napoleon. Yes, tell them to bring my horse. He mounted and rode towards Semyonovsk. Neither Napoleon nor any of his generals had ever before seen such a ghastly spectacle, or so many slain in such a small area. The roar of guns, which had not ceased for 10 hours, wearied the ear and gave a special significance to the scene, like music accompanying tableau vivant. Napoleon rode up to the hilltop at Semyonovsk and through the smoke saw ranks of soldiers in uniforms of unfamiliar colors. They were the Russians. The Russians were drawn up in serried ranks behind the knoll and village of Semyonovsk, their guns booming incessantly and filling the air with smoke all along the line. It was no longer a battle. It was a protracted slaughter, futile for both the French and the Russians. Napoleon pulled up his horse and again sank into the brown study from which Berthier had aroused him. He could not stop what was going on before and around him, an enterprise ostensibly led by him and dependent on him, and for the first time, because of its lack of success, it struck him as unnecessary and appalling. One of his generals rode up to Napoleon and took the liberty of offering to lead the old guard into attack. Ney and Berthier, who were standing near Napoleon, exchanged glances and smiled contemptuously at this preposterous suggestion. Napoleon's head sank, and he remained silent for some time. At 800 leagues from France, I do not intend to have my guard destroyed, he said, and turning his horse, rode back to Shevardino. That was the end of chapter 34 in book 3. My name is Conrad Lynn.
Myra Allen, page 967 through page 975. Kutuzov sat on the rug-covered bench where Pierre had seen him in the morning, his head drooping, his heavy body relaxed. He issued no commands, but simply gave or withheld his assent whenever anything was suggested to him. Yes, yes, do that, he replied to various proposals. Yes, yes, go, my dear boy, go and have a look, he would say to one or another of his entourage. Or, no, don't, we'd better wait. He heard the reports that were brought to him, gave an order when his subordinates required it of him. But when listening to the reports, he appeared to be interested not so much in the words that were spoken to him as in the expression or tone of voice of the man reporting to him. Long years of military experience had taught him, and the wisdom of old age had convinced him, that it is impossible for one man to direct hundreds of thousands of men struggling with death. And he knew that the fate of a battle is decided not by the dispositions of the commander-in-chief, nor by where the troops are stationed, nor by the number of cannons or of men killed, but by that intangible force called the spirit of the army. And he took cognizance of that force and guided it insofar as it lay in his power. Kutuzov's general expression was one of calm, concentrated attention, and of strain, as though he were hard put to master the fatigue of his weak and aging body. At 11 o'clock, the news was brought to him that the flesh captured by the French had been retaken, but that Prince Bagration was wounded. Kutuzov groaned and wagged his head. "Ride over to Prince Pietro Ivanovich and find out the details," he said to one of his adjutants, and turning to the Prince of Württemberg, who was standing behind him, said, "Will Your Highness please take command of the First Army?" Soon after the prince's departure, so soon, in fact, that he could not have reached Semyonovsk, his adjutant came back to report that the prince requested more troops. Kutuzov frowned and sent an order to Dokhturov to take command of the First Army, and he asked that the prince, whom he said he could not spare at such a critical time, return to him. When they brought him the news that Murat had been taken prisoner, Kutuzov smiled. "Wait, gentlemen," he said. "The battle is won, and there is nothing extraordinary in the capture of Murat. Still, it is better to wait a bit before rejoicing." Nevertheless, he sent an adjutant to take the news to the troops. When Scherbinin came galloping from the left flank with the news that the French had captured the flesh and the village of Semyonovsk, Kutuzov, inferring from the sounds of battle and the look on Scherbinin's face that the news was bad, got up as though to stretch his legs, and taking Scherbinin by the arm, led him aside. "Go, my dear fellow," he said to Yermolov, "and see whether something can't be done." Kutuzov was in Gorky, the center of the Russian position. The attack directed by Napoleon against our left flank had been several times repulsed. In the center, the French had not got beyond Borodino, and on their left flank, Uvarov's cavalry had put the French to flight. Toward 3 o'clock, the French attack ceased. On the faces of all who came from the battlefield and of those who stood around him, Kutuzov noticed an expression of extreme tension. He was satisfied with the day's success, which had exceeded his expectations. But the old man's strength was failing. Several times his head drooped as though falling, and he sank into a doze. Dinner was brought to him. Adjutant General Volzhagin, the man whom Prince Andrei had overheard saying, "The war must be extended over a broader area," and whom Bagration so detested, rode up while Kutuzov was at dinner. Volzhagin came from Barclay de Tolly to report on the progress of the battle on the left flank. The perspicacious Barclay de Tolly, seeing crowds of wounded men running back and the rear of the army in disorder, weighed all the circumstances, concluded that the battle was lost, and sent his favorite officer to the commander-in-chief with this news. Kutuzov, who was chewing on a piece of roast chicken with some difficulty, glanced at Volzhagin with eyes that narrowed with amusement. Volzhagin nonchalantly stretched his legs and approached Kutuzov with a half-contemptuous smile, barely touching the peak of his cap. He treated His Serene Highness with a certain affectation of indifference, the aim of which was to show that, as a highly trained military man, he left it to the Russians to make an idol of this useless old man, but that he knew whom he was dealing with. Der alte Herr, as the Germans referred to him amongst themselves, is making himself quite comfortable, thought Volzhagin, and with a stern glance at the dishes in front of Kutuzov, proceeded to report to the old gentleman the state of affairs on the left flank, according to Barclay's orders, and as he himself saw it. All points of our position are in the hands of the enemy, and they cannot be driven back because we haven't the troops to do it. The men are running away, and it's impossible to stop them, he announced. Kutuzov stopped chewing and stared at Volzhogin in amazement, as if not comprehending what was said to him. Volzhogin, noticing the old gentleman's agitation, said with a smile, I did not consider myself justified in keeping from your highness what I have seen. The troops are in complete disorder. What have you? What you have seen? Shouted Kutuzov, and glowering at Volzhogin, he hastily rose and walked up to him. How dare you? He cried in a choked voice, raising his trembling arms in a threatening gesture. How dare you, sir, say that to me? You know nothing about it. Tell General Barclay from me that his information is incorrect and that the actual course of the battle is better known to me, the commander-in-chief, than to him. Volzhogin was about to make a rejoinder, but Kutuzov interrupted him. The enemy has been repulsed on the left and defeated on the right flank. If you are unable to see well, sir, then do not permit yourself to speak of what you don't know. Be so good as to return to General Barclay and inform him of my firm intention to attack the enemy tomorrow, said Kutuzov. All were silent, and the only sound to be heard was the heavy breathing of the old general. They have been repulsed at all points, for which I thank God and our brave army. The enemy is defeated, and tomorrow we shall drive him from the sacred soil of Russia, said Kutuzov, crossing himself and suddenly uttering a sob as his eyes filled with tears. Volzhogin shrugged his shoulders, and his lip curled as he walked away in silence, marveling at the old gentleman's obsession. Ah, here he is, my hero, said Kutuzov to a portly, handsome, black-haired general who was at this moment ascending the hill. It was Raevsky, who had been the whole day at the most critical point of the Borodino field. Raevsky reported that the men were steadfastly standing their ground and that the French were not risking a further attack. After hearing him, Kutuzov said in French, Then you do not think, like some others, that we are compelled to retreat? On the contrary, your highness, in an indecisive engagement, it is always the most tenacious side that emerges victorious, replied Raevsky. And in my opinion... Kayserov, Kutuzov called his adjutant. Sit down and write out the order of the day for tomorrow. And you, he turned to another adjutant, ride along the line and announce that tomorrow we attack. While Kutuzov was talking to Raevsky and dictating the order of the day, Volzhogin returned from Barclay and said that General Barclay de Tolly wished to have written confirmation of the order that the field marshal had given him. Kutuzov, without looking at Volzhogin, directed that the order be written out, which the former commander-in-chief so prudently required in order to avoid all personal responsibility. And by means of that mysterious, indefinable bond that maintains throughout entire armies an identical temper known as the spirit of the army, and which constitutes the chief sinew of war, Kutuzov's order for the battle the next day was instantaneously communicated to every part of the army. The words, the exact form of the order, were by no means the same when they reached the furthest links of that chain. The accounts passing from mouth to mouth in the various units did not even resemble what Kutuzov had said, but the sense of his words spread from one end of the army to the other, because what he said was not the result of shrewd calculation, but of a feeling that lay deep in the soul of the commander-in-chief as it did in that of every Russian. And when they learned that tomorrow they were to attack the enemy and receive from the highest quarters of the army confirmation of what they wanted to believe, The exhausted, unnerved men took comfort and courage. Prince Andrei's regiment was among the reserves which, till after 1 o'clock, were stationed behind Semyonovsk, inactive and under heavy artillery fire. Toward 2 o'clock, the regiment, which by then had lost over 200 men, was moved forward into a trampled oat field in the gap between Semyonovsk and the Knoll Battery, where thousands of men perished that day, and on which, between 1 and 2 o'clock, an intensely concentrated fire from several hundred enemy guns was directed. There, without moving from the spot or firing a single shot, the regiment lost another third of its men. In front, especially on the right, the guns boomed incessantly, and out of that mysterious region, perpetually shrouded in smoke, came the swift hiss of flying cannonballs and the more slowly whistling grenades. Now and then, as if to allow the men a respite, a quarter of an hour would pass during which the missiles flew past them. But at other times, several men would be torn from the regiment within a minute, and the dead were continually being dragged away and the wounded carried off. With each fresh hit, the chances of survival diminished for those who were left. The regiment was drawn up in lines of battalions, 300 paces apart. Nevertheless, the same mood prevailed throughout the regiment. All alike were taciturn and morose. Talk was rarely heard in the ranks and ceased altogether at every direct hit and the cry of "Stretchers!" Most of the time, by command of their officers, the men sat on the ground. One, taking off his shako, carefully loosened the lining and tightened it again. Another crumbled some clay between his palms and polished his bayonet. Another shifted the strap and tightened the buckle of his bandolier, while still another smoothed and rewound his leg wrappings and pulled on his boots again. Some built little houses of the tufts in the plowed field, or plaited straws of stubble. All of them appeared to be completely absorbed in these pursuits. When men were killed or wounded, when rows of stretchers were carried by, when some of our troops returned, or when great masses of the enemy came into view through the smoke, no one took any notice. But if our artillery or cavalry advanced, or the infantry was seen moving up, words of approval were heard on all sides. The liveliest attention, however, was attracted by quite extraneous incidents having nothing to do with the battle, as if these men, whose morale was depleted, found relief in ordinary, everyday occurrences. An artillery battery passed in front of the regiment, and a horse drawing one of the powder wagons put its leg over a trace. "Hey, look at the trace horse! Get her leg out, she'll fall! Hey, they don't see it!" were the comments shouted all along the line. Another time, general attention was attracted by a small brown dog, which had appeared from heaven knows where, busily trotting along in front of the regiment with its tail erect, till suddenly a cannonball fell close by, and it darted off with a yelp, its tail between its legs. Howls and shrieks of laughter rose from the whole regiment. But distractions of this kind lasted only a few minutes, and the pale and sullen faces of these men, who for 8 hours had been inactive, without food, and in constant fear of death, kept growing paler and more sullen. Prince Andrei, pale and depressed like everyone else in the regiment, paced up and down from one border to another in the meadow next to the oat field. His head bowed. Everything happened of itself. The dead were dragged back from the front, the wounded carried away, and the ranks closed up. If any soldier ran to the rear, he made haste to return at once. At first, Prince Andrei, considering it his duty to keep up the spirits of his men and to set them an example, had walked about among the ranks. But he was soon convinced that this served no purpose, that there was nothing they could learn from him. All the powers of his soul, like those of every soldier there, were unconsciously directed to keeping his mind off the horrors of their situation. He walked along the meadow, dragging his feet, rustling the grass, and contemplating the dust that covered his boots. Then he took long strides, trying to step on the tracks left by the mowers, then counted his steps, calculating how many times he would have to walk from one border to another to make a verst. Then stripped the flowers from the wormwood growing along the edge of the field, rubbed them between his palms, and inhaled their pungent, bittersweet aroma. Nothing remained of the previous day's thoughts. He was thinking of nothing at all. He listened with ears that had grown weary of the same sounds, distinguishing the hiss of flying projectiles and cannon reports, and glanced at the tiresomely familiar faces of the men in the 1st Battalion. Here it comes. This one's for us, he thought, hearing the approaching whistle of something flying out of that smoke-filled region. One. Another. Still another. A hit? He stopped and looked along the ranks. No, it's gone over. But that one hit. And he resumed his pacing up and down, trying to take long strides to reach the border in 16 paces. A hiss and a thud. 5 paces from him, a cannonball tore up the dry earth and vanished. A chill ran down his spine. Again he glanced at the ranks. Probably many had been blown up. A large crowd had gathered near the 2nd Battalion. Adjutant, he shouted. Order them not to crowd together. The adjutant, having obeyed the order, approached Prince Andrei. The battalion commander rode up from the other side. Look out! Cried a soldier in a terrified voice. And like a bird in swift flight coming to earth with a whir of wings, a shell landed almost noiselessly 2 paces from Prince Andrei. The horse, not having to question whether it was right or wrong to show fear, was the first to react, snorting, rearing, and almost throwing the major as it sprang to one side. The horse's terror was communicated to the men. Lie down, shouted the adjutant, throwing himself to the ground. Prince Andrei hesitated. The smoking shell, which had fallen near a clump of wormwood on the border of the plowed field in the meadow, spun like a top between him and the prostrate adjutant. Can this be death? Thought Prince Andrei, looking with unwonted yearning at the grass, the wormwood, and then at the wisp of smoke curling from the rotating black ball. I can't die. I don't want to die. I love life. Love this grass, this earth, this air. Even while he was thinking these thoughts, he remembered that people were looking at him. It's shameful, sir, he said to the adjutant. What kind of... He did not finish. There was the sound of an explosion, like the splintering of a window frame being ripped out. And at the same moment, a suffocating smell of powder, and Prince Andrei was hurled to one side, and flinging up his arm, fell face downward. Several officers ran up to him. Blood poured from the right side of his abdomen, making a great stain on the grass. The militiamen with stretchers who had been summoned stood behind the officers. Prince Andrei lay flat on his chest, his face in the grass, breathing in hoarse gasps. Well, what are you waiting for? Come along. The peasants took Prince Andrei by the legs and shoulders, but he moaned piteously. And the men exchanged glances and set him down again. Pick him up! Get him on there anyhow! Someone shouted. Once more they lifted him by the shoulders and laid him on the stretcher. Oh, my God, my God. What is it? In the belly. He's done for. Oh, my God. The officers were heard exclaiming. It whizzed right past my ear. Just grazed it, said the adjutant. The peasants, adjusting the stretcher to their shoulders, hastily set off along the path they had trodden to the dressing station. Keep in step! Ah, these peasants, cried an officer, putting his hand on the shoulder of one of the men to check the uneven pace that was jolting the stretcher. Keep in step, Fyodor. Hey, Fyodor, said the foremost peasant. That's it, I've got it now, said the one behind, delighted that he had fallen into step. Your Excellency. Ah, oh, Prince, said Timokhin in a trembling voice.